Or it may turn out that the God from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding. We humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. May we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for generations still to come. Amen.
Meeting of Parliament, Monday the 14th of February 2017, order of proceedings. Confirmation of minutes, the minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on the 18th and 23rd of January 2017.
May I find the minutes of correct?
Communications from the Chair, petitions, announcements, papers to be laid, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the honour today on the table, the Statement of Supplementary Estimates number 1 for 2015-16.
Order to lie.
Report of committees. Answers to all questions. We commence with question number 95, the Honourable Ellis Yannis.
Mr. Speaker, certain families have been taking four gates at the top of the steps of the recently refurbished Wellington Front upper promenade, leading towards the lower promenade, and also in the top of the steps of the upper promenade leading onto Langley Road.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, no, sir.
Mr. Speaker, could I ask the Honourable Minister to perhaps review the steps, particularly the ones leading to the lower from the price seat? I think, given it's a saying earlier that people will be playing with children and so on, it could be an event, an accident for the future. And perhaps they could consider placing gates at least on the street set at the top.
Well, Mr. Speaker, no one from the health and safety department or anybody has advised me that they are feet. I mean, they might be feet, but these have been there for nearly 300 years and no considerable accidents have happened since. So I don't see why there should be a gate there. The Honourable Member must remember. So this is supposed to be an open space where people walk through and use the amenities. By putting a gate, it seems as if you have to close the whole area, which has recently been refurbished. So I don't agree with the Honourable Member in his suggestion.
Question number 96, the Honourable E.J. Hill.
Following on from answers provided to question number 1 of 2017, can the Minister for Sport update his house in respect to the Assistant Resources Manager Grade 4 vacancy within the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the position remains vacant, but management of the GSLA have initiated the internal recruitment process.
does that include that being to me has taken place or date is intended to take place?
Mr. Speaker, the vacancies were announced within internally, and as I understand it, there have been two applicants, and therefore the process of interviewing will come.
Question number 97, the Honourable E.J. Hayden.
Further to the answer provided to question number 4 of 2017. Can the Minister for Sport say when the last quarterly maintenance checks were carried out in respect to the satellite at all the facilities situated at the Victoria Stadium and Bayside Sports Complex, together with any details if there was a need for call out services for emergencies and or ad hoc repairs equipment?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sports.
Mr. Speaker, the last quarterly maintenance checks at the Victoria Stadium and the Bayside Sports Complex were conducted in November 2016. In addition, a number of satellite fittings were replaced on pitch number 2 and pitch number 3 and 4 in early December 2016.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Given that these are quarterly, and I'm taking it that for the calendar quarter, because does the Minister have any information when the next quarterly test is due? Technically, I know 3 months have elapsed, but if this is in a quarter, whatever, we could enlighten us about.
Well, yes, Mr. Speaker, as I understand it, these fittings were put in place in pitch number 3 and 4, and they were replaced. 3 have failed in total and in both facilities. The GSLA are currently dealing with the local contractors to determine the exact reason for this and to have these replaced as soon as possible, i.e. therefore, by deduction is that they are on constantly, even though they are checked quarterly, whenever things happen, and as I told you, I remember last time, that people are on call, so when anything fails, they react straight away. And he writes that the next general quarterly would happen within the next 3 months. So I'm sure they're doing it even as we speak, because if things do fail, then they check it again. So the quarterly checks are done just in case they're not failing. So they're checked that they don't fail in the future, but they are currently being looked at, especially pitch, like I said, pitch number 3 and 4.
Question number 98, the Honourable E.J. Hayden.
Can the Minister for Sport provide updated information in respect to the Gibraltar Football Association's national team or club's possibilities to play the forthcoming official international home games at the Victoria Stadium?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, this question should be directed to the Gibraltar Football Association. The Haitian government is not responsible for hosting of international football matches. We continue to work on a long-term plan with the GFA and provide support where we are requested to do so.
Mr. Speaker, can I ask you, the Minister, as chairman of the Gibraltar Sports Relations Authority, does he have any information to provide? One here is that there could be or could not be a possibility of a game due to the fitness or certification of the pitch. I mean, that's respecting, or the details in respect of the readiness or certification of the pitch lies in the Sports Authority. Does he please provide some information in that respect?
Mr. Speaker, As the authority is concerned, the pitches are fit to play. They've been played on currently, and they are fit to play. It is then up to the GFA with WEFA to ascertain whether they are happy with the pitch being played on. So therefore, I direct the Honourable Member to ask the GFA whether they feel via WEFA or FIFA whether the pitch is suitable to play.
The minister may have answered it, I haven't quite understood this. I know the pitch is a fit for play because they were playing them only yesterday. But do they have still a certification that meets the basic requirements that are set down by US or FIFA? And that, of course, authorities are the ones who hold the certificate. And, you know, from when the certificate was last run, it was an expiry date. Has that date come and gone? Has it been renewed? Can we please provide some information in that respect?
The FIFA, I repeat, according to the authority, the pitches are certified to be played on, even though they wouldn't be played on. So therefore, as far as the authority is concerned, matches can be played. Now, it is now up to FIFA or UEFA to come and certify, and they are the ones that they decide whether it is up to their standards. So therefore, it is up to the GFA to have discussions with UEFA and FIFA to see if this pitch is adequate for them or not. As far as the authority is concerned, it is adequate for us.
So, you speak of, as far as the authority is concerned, we currently hold certification that allows the pitch to be used for UEFA and for FIFA games, and that is the case when do those expire, when it is not due to be inspected and recertified.
If you think of the certification, as far as I understand it, goes either to June, July, and therefore up to June, July, these pitches. But I insist that the authority, even in June and July, we can get laboratory certifications of the pitch to be good and adequate for use of the pitch. And therefore, it is up to FIFA and UEFA, who they have their own regulations, to come probably during or after that date to see if it's adequate for them. So therefore, I would direct that question to the GFA and not to the government or the authority.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, so I'm glad to hear that so far we seem to be continuing on the process that's been there for a long time. The current certification is valid until June or July. If I recall correctly, what we used to do is that we used to bring in the maintenance team that we have contact with in order to ensure everything is up to date when it is due to the certification. Is the certification due to expire June or July? Does the minister have any idea when the individual is called and whether the authorities can extend to have their own external maintenance team coming over to ensure that when the US and FIFA do send their own people that as far as the goals of sports and the authority is concerned, everything possible has been done in order to regain the certificate?
Well, Mr. Speaker, knowing the authorities they do, and the Honourable Member as well, I am sure that the authority would be a couple of months before asking the laboratory to certify to see if there might be any possible extension to that certification. But it is too early to say. We are just, 4 or 5 months for the certification, so I'm sure the authority will get proper certification of the pitch well before the
The original question relates to the possibility of the Victoria Stadium being played to host official international matches. Now, the question which has been asked in supplementary about certification, but is it really an issue about certification of the pitch as to whether the pitch is of a quality that can host international matches? Or is it more complex than that? And does it involve, in fact, the standard, the facilities that the actual Victoria Stadium offers, so that then that will comply with UEFA or FIFA standards, which would allow home matches to be played at Victoria Stadium?
If there was a spoken answer given by the Honourable Gentleman, it would be clear that the issue relates to the pitch, to the playing surface. What we have to reflect on is that in the time that we have been here, on this side of the house, we have seen that the GFA has seen two hugely important milestone in its history, in the history of the world, in the history of football. First, admission to the European Federation, UEFA, and second, admission to the International Federation, FIFA. In the context of that, there are certain requirements which are of UEFA and certain requirements which are FIFA, and for some reason they are not identical. I'm really quite surprising that that would be the case, but they are not. And the things that the GFA are saying to the government relate to the requirements of those international organisations on them, on the GFA, and how the government can assist them in discharging those obligations in order to be able to play international matches of the national squad here and play international matches and European matches of the clubs here. Those relate in relation to the story essentially to the pitch. Because the Honourable Gentleman knows that UEFA have not wanted to entertain the opportunity for international matches, European matches, to be played at the stadium for reasons that they put to the GFA and the GFA has set out repeatedly. So, from the point of view of the works that were required for the Victoria to be the sort of facility that the government felt it could provide for the community generally, not just the football, because Victoria is for all sports in all the community. That work has been done, and the issues which relate, as I understand it, as I know my honourable friend understands it, to FIFA matches, the issues relate to the playing surface. But is that also the case with UEFA? Because my understanding was that the reason why international matches could not be played at the Victoria Stadium, particularly international matches for UEFA, is because the stadium was not a Category 3 UEFA stadium, it was just below a Category 3 UEFA stadium. So are the issues relating to UEFA and FIFA the same, or is FIFA pitch related and is UEFA stadium related?
Mr. Speaker, in relation to FIFA, the issues that I understand them are pitch related, and in relation to UEFA, as I understand it, they are facilities related and pitch related. If you think of it, and I'm going to come back to the General Minister, he said that the current situation of the pitch is valid in June or July. Looking at the calendar for coming games, the World Football Association is due to play its qualifying games in respect of FIFA, I think it's in the 9th of June. Therefore, that, I think, calendar-wise, should fit in within the certification period. Can the Minister sort of confirm to all such levels of the staff as it was, of course, the Labour Authority? The pitch is there, fully certified, and therefore, if the World Football Association wish, they could carry out, or they could play that game in the Victoria Stadium in June of this year.
Correct. Question number 99, the Honourable Alex Young.
Mr. Speaker, has the government taken a decision whether it is going to enforce the law or amend the law in respect of self-balancing two-wheeled electricity, powered hoverboards and scooters?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, the government is presently reviewing the position in relation to the importation and use of hoverboards and other similar self-balancing devices.
So that means the Senate Speaker that what was in the press release last December 2015 would actually not be enforced where government informed the community that these items would be seized regardless of whether they were imported or already imported.
No, Mr. Speaker, that's not what will happen. These items are illegal imports. These items are prohibited and to be used on the public highway and on the public footpath. So the problem here has been that obviously many of these electric power boards
whole voice has actually come in, found his way into the data, and now obviously there's a question of the policing and to look after that issue. Now, when it comes to the government position, at the moment what is happening is that we're actually looking at see whether, you know, there is a need to look at these more toy type related devices in a different way, because you can't really compare what you just said, Ray, which you spoke about in last month's parliament, with the biggest piece of equipment that can be used on the public highways through the law permitted, and or the footpath, and the other devices which are more toys in nature. They have a very short range, and they could not withstand, being driven or being rolled or driven on the road itself. So what we're looking at is to see whether there's any need to classify these toys as toys, and whether there's any need perhaps to assign in certain areas if it was decided that they were to be classified as toys. But as I said, this is all what the commission is, or what the group is looking at the moment, and this is where we are at the present.
Mr. Speaker, obviously, there is a secondary concern with this, that at the moment, that it stands, they are illegal imports, and obviously, apart from being used on public highways and in any area where at the moment they are undesignated, there is also an issue where there's been reports abroad internationally where they have caught fire. Obviously, if my neighbour, for example, let's say that my person neighbour has it, but if my neighbour has a soldier and that's caught his fire, and it causes a damage to his property and my property as a result, then the home centers and things wouldn't cover. So I think we need to tackle this one way or another. Obviously, the position of the government as of December 2015 was in fact that the authorities may therefore seize any temporary law equivalent found to be possessing the legal Gibraltar. And if that is not being enforced, then I call on the government to do something responsibly and quickly, and either call them toys and give them designated areas, or start treating them, because otherwise they're just allowing people to break the law and not do anything about it.
Mr. Speaker, the comments you've made on the fact that it's been reported that the family has set fire. Apparently, I'm informed that there are different types of these scooters. Some of them have a CE rating, which we assume are perfectly safe, and others, some from other countries, perhaps, are the ones that have caught fire in fact. In fact, again, the airline companies won't allow them on board for that very reason. But I'm informed that it is the other type. Now, it's very difficult, obviously. To, I mean, it's customs and everything, the law enforcement and body's responsibility to police the laws of the government's responsibility. So, if any state is caught, it is up to the IGB to deal with. But at the end of the day, I mean, if the IGB receives a report, then you say, for example, that your neighbor has a state, then it would be a little clearly a policy matter.
Mr. Speaker, obviously, I don't think the IGP needs anybody to call and call on any neighbour or anything that has blatantly been moved all over Gibraltar. And obviously, if they were regulated, then perhaps having to say a certain site which is regulated and licensed and is not originating from a few generic version of it will not be allowed, and the settlement will be allowed. And I think we really need to tackle this issue, because obviously we've seen a surge over the Christmas period, and obviously the fact that they are being used will only seem to encourage others to get any virus in the mix or to the cheaper rather than the proper one which is regulated.
Mr. Speaker, these things happen. They are illegal against the law, the laws are stated clearly. This is a question to warn people before Christmas when you are this year. Not to import these items because they were not allowed. So the law is there, and the police need to ensure that they deal with people who are driving these things on a public highway. I mean, you say it is a clearly seen way, it is a policing matter.
and they're the ones responsible to police the laws and the laws.
I'm fine with supplementing with the speaker.
Has the government actually advised you as you see much like this? For example, in notably, the speaker seems to in the public place, there were children walking up and down the street, well, not walking, hovering, and advising these items. And there's plenty of IGP, no need for anybody to call and call the IGP. And obviously, when you see the police, they literally just turn your blind eyes and is an instruction, or what is the case to you? Do you think that there has to be some form of policy from government to stifle that, that enforcement of the law, I presume?
Mr. Speaker, the government has no constitutional power. And as a matter of fact, on this side of the house, we would never determine to advise the RDP on what to do, to give the RDP instructions on what they have to do, or to attempt to stifle them in the exercise of their duties. But, Mr. Speaker, on this side of the house, I think the RDP do a very good job. But on that side of the house, it's clear that they're complaining about the way the RDP do their job. Mr. Speaker, I have no doubt that if any member of the RDP is listening, they will be very clear in respect to the attitude that the opposition takes to the sterling work that they do for our community.
Mr. Speaker.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker. If I can just intervene, I declare an interest here, but for example, my own children keep asking me for hoverboards because they feel these other children with the hoverboards on that, the law is not being enforced. So there is some confusion going on around here. So I think that what the Honourable Gentleman is asking for more than anything is clarity. I don't believe the respect that he's having a go at the RGP, but what exactly is the position going on at the moment? Because we do see it all around and nothing is being done to stop it.
So, Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Honourable Lady's clarification of what it was that another member of the House was supporting the asking. But it is, of course, a much better way of setting out what might be the concerns of members of the community, and I appreciate that. But Mr. Speaker, the position is the Honourable Minister has set out as far as the government's concerns is concerned. We set out what the position is in law, the enforcement of that, Mr. Speaker, is a matter entirely for customs and for the police. People sometimes talk about being in power. When you are in administration, you realize that there's pretty little by way of power. One is not able to direct police officers, customs to do or not do things, otherwise one would come entirely across by the Constitution. But the Honourable Lady raises the point of certainty. And in the view of the government, the position is clear. That is why, if my children ever are these things, they're going to get a very clear answer from Dad that there's not going to be a hoverboard at home. And for very good reason, because when you go to the substance of this debate, why is it that something that actually looks quite fun is something that the government has decided cannot be imported or used as a motor? And based on advice, because of the size of our roads, because of the technical problems that there were with the batteries that were in the boards, etc. It may be interesting that there was an argument for designating areas where this sort of equipment can be used. And a bicycle is a lot of fun, but you can't ride your bicycle in main street because you could hurt people who are there enjoying the pedestrian facilities. So there may be an argument to raise there, and it's something that the government is certainly considering. Skateboarding parks where you use your skateboard, using your skateboard in main street is not allowed. But skateboards are not an illegal import, and they don't catch fire, unless you ride them really well, I guess. But there are arguments to be had to rationalize this particular area, but they don't relate to criticizing the police or criticizing other law enforcement agencies, and I guess the Honourable Lady has taken this very good decision.
The Honourable Lady, the Honourable Lady, I'm sorry, but the Honourable Lady has caught my eye before we spoke.
Mr. Speaker, I think that the Honourable the Chief Minister has basically taken it to the core of the debate in relation to this, and it's this. The government has taken a decision not to allow the importation of these items because the government is concerned about the safety. Now, in the light of that, and in the light of the concern expressed by my honourable friend, Mr. Yam, that he had personally, and indeed, almost after all, just been personally, people using, including using these items down the street and elsewhere. And therefore, that there must be a safety issue in relation to this, because what we don't want is for children to have an accident. What is the government going to do about that? Because I can't understand that the enforcement is for the police to enforce. But clearly, if the government knows that these items are in Gibraltar and they are being used, and that the law is perhaps not being enforced, or there might be some confusion in relation to the law, I don't know. But the reality is that they are being used. I would have thought that the onus, or there would be some responsibility on the government service to do something about it. And Speaker, I know that there is cannabis in Gibraltar and that it is being smoked. But I don't complain about the RDP's enforcement of our rules against cannabis, because of course there is an agenda to deal with that. It is an agenda, and the RDP to deal with all of these issues, and not just in the police, all law enforcement agencies. But I think, Speaker, in the context of the debate as it is now developing, if you allow the question, the answers must come. But what a privilege that with everything that is happening in the world, we have the opportunity of debating hoverboards and segways in this parliament. And we sometimes don't realize just how lucky we are in Gibraltar. Speaker, let me just set in context what has happened here so that we understand the parameters of action and who took the action. The issue of the prohibition relates to segways, actually, started with segways, and it came also in the light of a lot of people winning prizes in the Alumni Fair, which were skateboards with engines on them. And I remember at that time there was a flurry of political activity relating to whether these items should be banned because they were dangerous. And it was not this government, it was the former administration that took the advice of customs and the police to introduce that ban. And the policing of the ban is something which is a matter, as I say, not for us. It's very easy on something as easy to understand and as visible and innocuous as a motorized skateboard to take the bait of agreeing that, of course, it must to indicate to law enforcement agencies that they should do a little more in this area or not. But our constitutional structure is very clear, and I have on my desk a letter asking me, as Chief Minister, under the provisions of the Gibraltar Police Authority Act, to set out what my priorities are in respect of policing in Gibraltar for the next year. That is what the Act provides for. The Gibraltar Police Authority writes to me. I think they also write to others. That is put together in a police authority report. I will not be putting on my list of things which are the government priorities for policing in Gibraltar in the next year, that police officers should be chasing hoverboards, Mr. Speaker. I think that I've indicated to the Honourable Lady's more sensible approach to the question how it is that the government proposes to deal with some aspects of this, the aspects that relate to government competency, and I have full confidence in the law enforcement agencies in Gibraltar now and how to deal with the issues that are being raised. They are not just being raised here, they are being raised in other fora as well. And the Speaker of the Community knows that we have an excellent police force and an excellent customs department that we know how to deal with these concerns.
Question number 100, the Honourable T.N. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can government provide an update as to when it intends to publish the final version of its still draft sustainable traffic transport and parking plan, and thereby accept accountability for the entirety of its content?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, the government will publish the final version of its draft sustainable traffic transport and parking plan very shortly. Mr. Speaker, could the Minister provide not necessarily a specific definition, but he's been saying very shortly, really for about 4 years now, I was thinking about very shortly maybe a month from now, or very shortly, maybe 12 months from now. What's some idea of what you mean by that?
Very shortly, has a definition in history. The only gentleman would want him to obviously give him a specific date and then hold him to it. But I will let you know that as per the definition in history, shortly means very shortly means very soon.
Indeed, but because the minister has been giving that response for over a year now, that wouldn't fit into my definition of very shortly. Very shortly, to me, means something that is happening or going to happen imminently, not something that could happen sometime in the next 3, 4 years, which is why I asked the question, not for the answer to the minister to give a specific date for which I can hold him to account. I'm not asking for that. I'm just asking for an impression of what he understands from his answer very shortly, because to ensure that it aligns with what my understanding and perhaps those of many members of the public is of very shortly.
Well, Mr. Speaker, we are taking our definition of shortly as defined in the dictionary and in Hansard, Mr. Speaker, and there is a huge amount of debate in respect of the definition of shortly and very shortly. In the context of the Hansard of 2003 to 2007, which I commend to the Honourable Gentleman.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Honourable Chief Minister for his answer. All I can say is that I hope I don't have to ask the questions on the 6 months time.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for that comment, although I don't detect an answer in it. But if he does do the exercise of going back to the Hansard, he might be surprised to note what his own party's definition of shortly was, and given that he defended their record in the general election and commended it to the general public, I assume he hasn't changed his view on what shortly means, but we see.
Question number 101, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise if it has made a decision in respect to the one expression of interest received, the leasing of vehicle fleets, and if so, what the financial terms, what are the financial terms of it?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, not yet.
I'm grateful to the Honourable Minister's response. Can I ask him if he has any intention of re-advertising the expression of interest tender, seeing as he only had one expression of interest?
Okay. No, Mr. Speaker. Question number 102, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Nahum.
Can the Transport Minister look into the possibility of adding the night buses to the Bus Charter Act?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, the Gibraltar Bus Charter Web app is currently under development and all routes will be included in the platform. The ninth route, N8, is also currently under development by the IT department.
Can the Minister for Transport give us an idea more or less when the app will be ready?
Certainly, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 103, the Honourable Ellis Lemon.
Mr. Speaker, following question 147 of 2016,
Canada government provided Treasury with a detailed breakdown of the rights and nature of the work involved, together with a broken down cost of the same undertaking and the period during which these rights commenced and finished.
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 104 to 106, 108, 111 and 112.
Question number 104, the Honourable Ella Piana.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a schedule detailing by month the total number of visitors to the Upper Office since December 2011, to date broken down into the following categories? A. Private vehicles, B. Taxis, C. Coaches, C. Cable cars, D. Walking, F. Walking with a taxis included, Q. 100 kilograms.
Question number 105, the Honourable Ellis Piana.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a monthly schedule detailing the running cost per attack in the site in the Upper Office since December 2011, broken down into the following? A. Wages and salaries, B. Electricity, C. General maintenance, C. Refurbishment, and C. Any other expense.
Question number 106, the Honourable Ellis Piana.
The Speaker, can the government provide a schedule detailing by month the total revenue collected in commission to the Upper Office administration fees since December 2011 to date, breaking down into the following categories? A. Private vehicles, B. Taxis, C. Coaches, D. Cable cars, E. Walking only, F. Walking with cycling freedom, and D. 100 kilograms.
Question number 108, the Honourable Ella Piana.
So the Speaker, prior to written question 11 of 2017, can the government explain how did they do not hold any statistics of visitors to the World War II summit, given average and child schools must pay an additional 8 and 4 pounds respectively, and locals must pay 5 pounds to enter the site?
Question number 111, the Honourable Ellis Yannis.
So the Speaker, can the government give an opening date for the Foreign Relations Chamber in the Great Sea of Panama?
Question number 112, the Honourable Ellis Yannis.
Mr. Speaker, can the government explain why O'Hara's factory may have a state station for Monday to Friday, but the main exhibition remains closed and since Wednesday has been closed?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to questions 103 to 106, the information requested is in the schedules that I now hand over. Let me just explain, Mr. Speaker, that the breakdown into the different heads by month involves a considerable amount of work. So I have provided the information by year. And the staff is currently breaking down that further, but with your permission, Mr. Speaker, and that of a member of it, that will have to come to him later. So we've broken it down by year, but further subdivision of all the different expenditures in all the different areas by month is quite an onerous task, and with your permission, and that of a member of it, that will follow. And he knows that he has an open line to me if he thinks it's taking rather too long. I'm told by the end of the week. But I'm happy to be reminded, if you would bear with me on that one. In relation to question 108, the government has not stated that we don't hold any statistics of visitors to World War II tunnels. But the statement in the title of question 11 of 2017 was the fact that locals, visitors arriving at the tunnel by taxi, and those arriving by tour operator coach, are charged the same concessionary taxi, and they're all presented with the same type tickets on entry. So the total number of sales for this ticket type incorporates all three types of visitors, and therefore exclusive figures for local only cannot be presented. Now we are reviewing this, Mr. Speaker. The Conway Chamber is scheduled to open today. I haven't checked whether it has, but that is my information. And in answer to question 112, a Harris Battery exhibition area has been closed since the 7th of October due to manning level issues. There is a requirement, Mr. Speaker, for site attendants to speak foreign languages, and it's proving difficult to recruit persons with German, Dutch, and other required languages. This said, the external areas of the site have remained open from Monday to Friday, allowing visitors to enjoy the garden placement and vistas from the highest point of the upper rock. We expect to have full complement shortly, and we will then be in a position to reopen the exhibition.
I'm grateful for the young minister's services and commitment to supply the detailed breakdown in the new system, and I'm very grateful that at least he's provided us with an overall view of a yearly basis. In relation to the World War II Fund, would I be able to come back next month and ask the minister for statistical analysis overall without having to ask for a breakdown of motives and truth? Would that be a possibility?
I need to check back with the team. As I said, the other view it does involve considerably more work because we don't just have to count the private secrets, we have to subdivide that. And as we're reviewing the whole question of the upper rock, it may need a little bit more time than next month, but again, I have to check with the team and confirm when we hope to have that information available.
If the speaker for me to come back to these questions once they have a chance to review it, if I have any supplementaries and have any other questions, thank you.
Question 107, the Honourable Ellis Yamas.
Mr. Speaker, prior to written questions, 10 of 2017, can the government explain the rationale for exempting taxi drivers from paying the admission fees to the upper rock in 18 days?
Calling for the Honourable the Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 114.
Question number 114, the Honourable Ellis Yamas.
Has the government reviewed its upper rock foreign registered vehicle policy since April 2016?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I'll answer the question 107 to assist taxi drivers in very shallow months of the year. Fees are paid in this period when visitors access the attractions on the upper rock nature reserve. And in answer to question 114, no, sir.
If I may just come back to the other questions are interconnected with each other, so while I analyze the overall outcome of the policy in terms of revenue and services and so forth. If I may come back to these questions later on, if I need to, thank you.
Question 109, the Honourable Ellis Yamas.
Speaker, prior to written question 17 of 2017, can the government provide an update on the rules for written a separate aid and debtor fee, together with a detail of any new debt and debtors which may have exceeded the budget period?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 110.
Question number 110, the Honourable Ellis Yamas.
Speaker, prior to written question 17 of 2017, can the government provide details of the arrears position as at the end of each financial year since April 2012 to date of any other arrears owed by the debtor A and debtor B to the government of Gibraltar, if any?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The Speaker, information requested by the Honourable Member in questions 109 and 110 is in the schedule that I now hand over.
Question number 113, the Honourable Ellis Young.
Mr. Speaker, what plans does the government have to replace failing railings in the airport, in particular on the road leading to Ohio's factory?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, a programme for the replacement of railings has commenced, and this area is in our priority list, but other areas will be tackled before this one. Railings in the Upper Rock have not been replaced for decades.
Question number 115, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, has government made any representations to the EU Commission in the aftermath of the Sepsa refinery incident on the 29th of January?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with sessions 116 and 132 and pick up that the 132 is said by the Honourable Lady. She may need to be advised, she's not in the chamber right now. That the question is coming up, you will not have expected it perhaps when I was going to link them up. But they are on the same subject, so that is the appropriate way of responding.
Question number 116, the Honourable T.N. Hammond.
The Minister for the Environment accepts the statement by Sepsa when it says that the flooding incident of the 29th of January had no impact on the environment.
Question number 132, the Honourable Minister M.D. Hassan Nawan.
Can the government reveal what is the nature of the complaint to the EU in connection with the flaring incident at Sepsa refinery on the 29th of January this year?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. The government has filed a complaint to the European Union Commission, which is done on the 6th of February. In answer to question 0116, which refers to whether I agree with the statement of that the flaring incident had no impact on the environment, this is probably the most predictable reply ever. No, sir. And in answer to question 132, the nature of the complaint is, and I summarize, to highlight the, and remind the Commission of the ongoing cases of flaring which have been occurring over the years at the Sepsa refinery, and highlighting the latest incident of the 29th of last month, the apparent lack of action on the part of the relevant competent authorities to ensure that Sepsa complies with obligations arising under EU law, our concerns in relation to the ensuing impact on public health and the environment in the region, and the lack of communication from the Spanish authorities to the relevant Gibraltar authorities when such events occur and on the operation of the complex as a whole. And because it's just a summary, in case I've missed anything, I'm providing members with a copy of the complaint as filed. I would just mention, Mr. Speaker, that because there are quite a number of appendices, they are not in printed form, but they will be made available electronically to the members within the course of today. It was just too much to print, but that is the substance of the main complaint. The appendices will follow by electronic means.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Minister for a copy of this complaint. I look forward to reading and I'm sure we'll be more than happy to support. If I could just go back to question 116, to when the Minister says no, he doesn't agree with the statement put out by Sepsa that the incident had no impact on the environment. Is he therefore suggesting that Sepsa has been economical with the truth to reference the incident?
Mr. Speaker, it's not for me to analyse what that means. I don't agree with the statement. Flaring is well known and practically declared by the European Environment Agency that the practice of flaring is dangerous and harmful to the environment. Emissions of pollutants from flaring may consist of unburnt fuel like methane, byproducts such as soot, which obviously particulate matter, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, oxides of nitrogen. Department of the Environment, and I say that I don't believe that that is correct. The conclusion as to what I think of such a statement is, I think, very obvious.
Mr. Speaker, in view of the Ministry's position with respect to the potential environmental damage that such incidents and certain flaring in general can cause, is the government considering taking any form of legal action against Spectra in this respect, or in respect to this incident?
The figure quickly reacted by filing this complaint, and we are considering all options.
Considering that the incident that happened, is the government looking at conducting an environmental impact study once again?
Environmental impact study precisely on the operation of Spectra?
Perhaps my jargon is mistaken. I mean, a study on the effect of the Spectra flaring incident for the refinery itself on human life and the environment.
It probably isn't necessary that there was an environmental audit of the plant in 2008, which was requested by the European Union. And that, in fact, highlighted the need to prioritize electrical failures of the plant, which is allegedly what happened on this occasion. So we have argued to the Commission that these do not appear to have been tackled. So whether there is a need to carry out a new environmental audit when one was done about 6 or 7 years ago, and with the conclusion of which we happen to agree, I think it's probably not necessary. But what we are doing is reminding the Commission of the results of that audit and how Spectra has failed to deliver on what that audit requires. It may not be necessary to conduct a new one, but depending on responses and so on, again, these are options that we will continue to keep open.
Was that environmental audit conducted as a consequence of the complaint that was made around about 2005-2006 in relation to the operation of the refinery? I gather it was the, as far as I can recall, I think it was related to the environmental safety group that made a complaint, and I think the organization was involved at the time.
It was the environmental safety group, and in my capacity with another NGO at the time, I think I was a signatory to that complaint. I certainly worked together with the USP on it. I would like to think it wasn't a result, but we must remember that there have been other complaints, some notably from environmentalists in the surrounding area. I don't know whether they have ever acknowledged cause and effect, but it was for that as a result of that complaint. I like to think that it was. And certainly, I think that complaint played a large part in requiring the audit. So I think we can be satisfied. I notice there's no difference across the House in this one. I think we can be satisfied of the work of our NGOs through the years and also the fact that we are working very closely with them in moving this forward, which is a concern for all of us. Fortunately for us, Mr. Speaker, on that particular day, it appears that the wind took the pollutants away from us, but that is no justification because there are communities on the other side of the bay who are obviously affected.
Peter, in the light of the fact, and of course, on this, the government and the opposition are going to be an item, but in the light of the fact that there have been serious complaints and that this keeps on occurring, what prospects does the Honourable Member think there's going to be for this complaint that the government has filed? And therefore, in the light of that, and in the light of the fact that there have been various complaints, and one of which appear really to have dealt with this particular issue, is it not perhaps the time to take it a step further and perhaps take action, a legal action against Spectra, as my Honourable friend Mr. Hammond has suggested in his previous question?
Mr. Speaker, as I replied to the Honourable Mr. Hammond, we're keeping our options open. I don't think we should publicly declare our strategy, but we are keeping our options open. It is something that concerns us greatly. Fortunately, they can't use the Brexit argument against us because that side of the border will stay within the EU, and therefore they will be tied to European requirements.
Mr. Speaker, I would remain very interested in the Minister's response to question number 116, reference to the sector's response to the incident, because clearly we have a case here where, and I will not suspect the Minister's opinion, because of his expertise in this area. And for that reason, it concerns me deeply that we should have a big oil company coming out very publicly saying, nothing to worry about here, what we've done is of absolutely no impact on the environment. Whereas I think even the layman would recognise that it has, and certainly the Minister with his greater and more in-depth knowledge would certainly know that it has had an impact on the environment. And therefore, it concerns me that there is a clear element, a clear issue of trust here in what we're being told by big oil companies and what the reality on the ground actually is. And would the Minister care to comment on that particular point?
Mr. Speaker, I don't think the whole member is asking me to give an opinion on big oil companies, and I certainly will not. I take the point. There are concerns as to what that particular company has said, and as I say, we are keeping our observation, but I don't think it would be sensible for me to label that point any further.
Question number 117, the Honourable
TNM. Mr. Speaker, would the government consider commissioning a further epidemiological study since the last one conducted in 2010 in order to allay public fears that cancer rates may be higher in Gibraltar than in similar communities in Europe?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the epidemiological study in 2010 was conducted in response to public fears about cancer and was carried out by Aarhus, a university in Denmark. Epidemiological data collected prior to that by the Public Health Department have not shown higher rates than normal, and I'll say that in quotation marks, and in many cases Gibraltar's rate appeared lower than that of many other countries. It's against this background that the study was undertaken, and it confirmed that, I quote, the total cancer incidence rate in Gibraltar is within the normal range of other European countries. Gibraltar is not a high-risk community for cancer. The former GSD administration accepted those findings and defended them here. This administration is not satisfied with those findings. We will therefore be carrying out a further study. Over the next 2 to 3 years, the successful completion of the electronic patient record project is expected to yield high-quality data that will enable the Gibraltar Cancer Registry to carry out similar epidemiological studies assessments in-house. At that time, the need for further research studies into specific aspects will be reviewed, and we will be including them as part of the further research in a new epidemiological study.
Question number 118, the Honourable T.N. Hammond.
Can the government confirm that the invitation to tender for the Master Services contract will be publicly issued? My apologies, Mr. Speaker, I was already tick-tacked behind the questioning event. With the re-tendering of the current Master Services contract, will government provide assurances that all employees of Master Services will be subjected to transfer of undertaking regulations and have both their jobs and terms and conditions protected?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 119 and 133.
Question 119, the Honourable T.N. Hammond.
Can the government confirm that the invitation to tender for the Master Services contract will be publicly issued?
Question number 143, the Honourable Ms. Andy Hassanah.
What are the reasons for the non-renewal of the long-standing contract of Master Services?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the government has already confirmed, although it was not necessary for us to do so, that employees of Master Services are covered by the protection of the transfer of undertaking provisions, which protect their jobs and terms and conditions of employment. The tender will be published in the European Union Journal as is required by EU law. The contract will shortly expire and it must therefore be dated in accordance with mandatory EU procurement procedures.
Mr. Speaker, as a subject to the rule of law, how many other companies will now be facing the same situation whereby other private companies will be subject to another tender process?
From the statement of the Speaker, as one of the ladies would expect, all of them whose contracts are within the provisions of the EU procurement rules.
Would it be possible to ask for a list of all other government contracts and date of expiry?
It is possible. I invite the Honourable Lady to put down a question for the next meeting, but we cannot expect information to be available today.
That's right, Mr. Speaker. Although we would have to look at every contract which the government has which falls within the parameters, there's only way that is something that could be done in 5 days. Because the government has another contract, looking at the parameters will require an assessment of all those contracts. But there is a procedure that as soon as one of these contracts comes up, they are flagged up. And I'm sure that honourable members were not surprised by this. Because we had a debate in this house where the honourable lady raised the issue, and when she was told that the contract was expiring in March, she may recall that when she got up and memorably said Gibraltar snow. And we had a long debate about whether Gibraltar was snowy or not. At that stage, there was another question from the opposition benches, suggesting that cleanliness was not up to scratch, and we were defending the fact that the contract was enforced and that it would come up for tender in March, and that therefore this was something that was long been carried and expected in this community, at the very least, to serve the number of roads at that time. As it's really meant to be addressed now today.
Any other supplementary on this matter? Next question.
Can I ask the contract, again, imagine that market holders will be stopping for work as soon as the contract ends. So, what renewal term will be given to them to ensure that the workers will not be in employment on a month to month basis, do you know?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the contract will expire and will be, I assume, in the context of whatever advice we have from procurement, as to what date they will be able to make final assessments in respect of tender submissions. Will probably be rolled over with an agreement for that period, subject to the advice from the procurement office. And that will be the date when we are confident that whoever takes over will be able to seamlessly start running the new service. It may very well be the same company or maybe another company. So the Speaker, this is not something that is fixed. It's something that has to be subject to advice from the procurement office. But I will tell him, Mr. Speaker, that we have serious concerns about the contract that is currently in place and whether it requires it in keeping with the new procurement office.
Mr. Speaker, and can the Honourable Speaker give us any assurances as to whether the new employer, the new contract, will encompass existing obligations in relation to pension schemes?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, because there is a law that deals with that. There is a specific law that deals with the issue that the Honourable Lady is raising. So she has the advantage that the transfer undertaking provision apply. In respect of this matter, there is a new contract which deals with the same subject matter. Because the other lady should not quite have the possibility that the existing company, the existing contract party, might be the contract party that enters into a new arrangement with the government. We have to ensure we get the best value for money for the taxpayer. We have an obligation to do that through an EU procurement scheme, which is the law of Gibraltar, and since it was directly effective under EU law, before we were elected, and if we can stay since law because it was already outside the provision for the transposition period, but it would bite at the time that the contract was granted before. So that's how we're going to ensure that this matter is determined, that's how we're going to ensure that the taxpayer gets best value for money, and that's how we're going to ensure that the bill is not made, so it doesn't have to ask the first question to go.
Mr. Speaker, my concerns were echoing those of the employees that I've been speaking to, who have a concern because that their pensions were frozen once at the first for the ones who've been working for over 18 years, and they're very concerned that this may happen again. So I put that concern to the Chief Minister. And I just ask whether if the new successful tender, whichever that may be, can they take into account other services that master services have provided? Like, they have, from what I understand, they have been exemplary in terms of taking care of ex-offenders, ex-drug addicts, people who have rehabilitated a lot of their working into society. Will that be a factor that the procurement will take into account in the new tender?
Well, the label they were putting to us that they were not exemplary in the way that they managed to fail at the rate of home. She raised that issue on a number of occasions in the course of the exchanges that I'm telling her about. I do not recognize in anything that she says anything to do with the government in respect of those intentions. It has nothing to do with us. I assume it had nothing to do with the former administration before. Nobody put that in an issue in relation to pensions having been frozen. It's not something we've heard about. A number of employers in the border are assessed with rehabilitation of people who have been in prison. It's something that we would expect most employers in the border would want to do. In fact, some of the most loyal employees that firm have come from the pool of people who've made a mistake in life, but are then given the opportunity to go on the straight and narrow. And they recognize that they've been given that opportunity by an employer, and they are very loyal indeed to those employers going forward. I recognize that Master Services has done some of that work. Other companies have also done some of that work. Given the sector in which they're in, it is an area where people are able to be given an opportunity because there is little by way of trust in the sector, of money, the sector, in the context of doing the frontline work at the coal face in an industrial cleaning contract. And I would expect that whoever was to be successful in taking the contract will often be prevailed upon by the Minister for the Environment to assist in that respect. I think I said the Shiver Down Environmentalist Fund when I pointed to Mr. Rudy in respect to the environment. I meant employment. I'm sure that this is something that whoever is successful will be able to compart it. Indeed, I'm reminded by the Minister of Economic Development that to be on the approved contractor list for the government, one is required to also form part of that program. But I am not for one moment suggesting that it may not be Master Services itself that succeeds in respect of the tender. It may very well be. They have the wealth of 18 or 20 years of experience with the people, so they may be the ones who are successful. But what's important to us on this side of the house is that we ensure that we get the best value for money for the taxpayer and that the vote is clean, so that liable lady does not have to sell us at the toilet at the other point, not to the standard that we would all expect them to be, and she was highlighting that as a complaint at the time, and so that nobody has to wait on social media and hear here that the vote is smelly. I am sure, Mr. Speaker, that this number will enable us to get closer to that standard of service we all wish, for the value for money that we expect.
Mr. Speaker, can I just clarify that I was not having a dig at Master Services itself, and I raised the issue of the toilet being smelly. It could have had a lot to do with the way that the government allocates contracts, working hours to Master Services, not necessarily a vote at Master Services itself. Secondly, I asked the Chief Minister, who's actually sat down with the main union, the GBCA, which holds most of the members of Master Services today, to find out the concerns that he claims he hasn't heard about yet. And also, I asked him to allay concerns that I hear widely that the new contract is actually already a factor from two.
Let me start again, because it really all behaves wrong the way to come to this house based on making allegations based on Nina, because she didn't spend her life in this house pushing issues to the government, which are entirely and completely untrue.
Mr. Speaker, I have heard all sorts of rumours about her, about all of them over there, and about each and every single one of us. Rumours which are unrepeatable, even in private to one wife, Mr. Speaker. But that's what the book is like. One hears rumours about everything. And the latest that I heard, one of the ones I heard, is that the contract is going to be awarded to a relative of the government, and this is the best way that we're going to be able to spot how tenders are not granted in a way that is fair, etc. Mr. Speaker, this is utter strife. It's complete and utter strife. People just make it up as they go along. The piece of the pudding will be in the eating, Mr. Speaker, and the other lady will not concern herself with bringing to a place like the Parliament matters which she hears as quickly tackled on the street. I take the point from the other lady that it is my fault that the toilets at the river point melt and they're not the required standard, and not the fault of the person whose job it is to run a company to ensure that the toilets are clean. I would have expected that from a politician. I didn't expect it from her. I thought she was the voice of reason. The reason, Mr. Speaker, must dictate that the government of the day allocating more resources than have ever been allocated in past terms in the respect of this context. I think that we've allocated almost a third or two-thirds more than used to be the case under the former administration, would have been entitled to expect that one might be able to eat one's dinner off the floor of the toilet and not have it smell. So the other lady must, if she was being honest with the way that she was dealing with matters, she must have been criticising matters services. I know that today the political advantages in aligning oneself with the employees of matters services and not in being where she was, with other honourable members of it, last year criticising the work done by matters services. We will be consistent, Mr. Speaker, in defending that we are going to seek the best value for money for the taxpayer, and that may even continue with matters services, or in all things, we need not concern ourselves with rumours that we might do otherwise. Mr. Speaker, finally, I have a meeting tomorrow afternoon with the union in question, who wishes that meeting that is going to be one of our regular monthly meetings to be dedicated to matters services, so I expect to see them then. I haven't met any other union in respect of this matter. In another meeting in relation to other matters with another union, the issue was raised with me on the front, and I gave my leave, and tomorrow we have a meeting with the union that is principally responsible for the employees there. I have no doubt that when they hear what the government has to say, they'll be much less concerned than they appear to be about the only issue that can matter for the union, namely the matters that relate to their employees. And one would have thought that any other matters beyond the remit of the union, I'm sure that tomorrow the meeting of the union will be about those issues. Mr. Speaker, I may come back to the tender itself. Would the minister or the chief minister be able to add some colour to the tender that the person can then explain or advise the House what is anticipated to be the length of the contract in December? I want to be a tender for all existing services as provided by Master Services today. Mr. Speaker, the tender notice will be published in the European Journal of the European Community. It will be inappropriate to comment further, given that that tender notice is required to come out with a specific period within which people can send them. You don't want to be putting information into the public domain piecemeal, but the Honourable Gentleman will be able to see the tender and be available online. I think it's also published in local newspapers in the difference between public in the European Journal. That is what's required. Mr. Speaker, I quite understand that in relation to the tender, that can the government give a view or some information in relation to its policy as to whether it intends to break up this contract into smaller segments, or whether its government policy is to tender for the entirety of what is now the Master Service contract?
Mr. Speaker, with the thought it was evident in what was said, there would be a tender. If it were intending to break it up, there would have been a number of different tenders. And if there were a number of different tenders, they might not cross the threshold of what is required to be advertised in at a European-wide scale. So the government has no intention of advertising anything other than one tender. In the context of the submissions, it may be that we receive the proposal to break it up, or that we receive piecemeal proposals. I don't think we can stop that, and the procurement will have to assess whether those piecemeal proposals either in whole or in part, or better than a whole contract as a present in the case, for all of Gibraltar, or just for specific parts. It may be that there are specific parts where somebody sends it, and that's more valuable. But as far as the government is concerned, it's very nice in one contract.
Question number 120, the Honourable Aaron Finty.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise what steps it has taken to prevent the demolition of the Northgate building of the dockyard, and has it sought the permission of the Secretary of State to lift the structure under the Gibraltar Heritage Trust Act?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the matter of the MOD Gatehouse has been the subject of public debate for some time now. The planning process through the Development and Planning Commission was carried out in the same manner that is applied to government projects. The recommendation of the DPC was that the gatehouse should not be demolished, and government was hopeful that the Minister of Defence would accept that decision. MOD moved to start enabling work for the demolition of the building. At this stage, after consultation with the Chief Minister, who was away from Gibraltar, I contacted the commander of British forces in my capacity as acting Chief Minister and offered to discuss possible ways of resolving the matter. Later, the Chief Minister and I met with His Excellency the Governor, and this was followed by meetings between Gibraltar government and MOD representatives in order to explore ways in which to protect or preserve the building. The building will now not be done away with, but will be moved to another location. Further information will be released soon, as soon as these planning meetings determine the best way forward. With regard to the second part of the question, the building was not listed in the Act, and the government will consider possible listing in the context of the new Heritage and Antiquities Act.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Minister for his response. Confirms to me that from his answer, that in fact there is no attempt to seek the existing structure, permission from the Secretary of State to be listed in its current location. Mr. Speaker, that provision is a provision that predates the 2006 Constitution. Matters relating to heritage are now entirely in the purview of the government of the government. The government of the government does not seem to be the appropriate to be seeking consent from the Secretary of State to list things in Gibraltar. There is a draft heritage and antiquities act that should soon be on the second book, and that will enable us to deal with issues of such as that in the future. But I must say to Honourable Gentlemen that I was happy to hear the response of the Gibraltar Heritage Trust to the work of my honourable friend within my absence from Gibraltar, and that it's been very honourable in respect of his responsibility, about the fact that the government has been able to find a way to ensure that this building is preserved for future generations. My own view is that it must be rebuilt in the area, it must be rebuilt quickly, and it must be rebuilt in a place where people can have access to it, so that this piece of heritage is one that our children can access and not that it feels confined to the wire. And as to moving this particular piece of our military heritage to the speaker, although I recognise it's not ideal, unfortunately the attitude of the Ministry of Defence was not the one that we might have expected. If it were only in relation to small heritage buildings, the speaker, one might have had an easier week last week. Let's be very clear. The Temple of Abu Simbel, the Temple of Ramesses II, was moved immediately, Mr. Speaker, because it might have flooded with the Aswan dam's creation, and it is now seen by many millions of people every year. It was a feat of engineering, the likes of which I remember seeing that had not occurred before in our history as a humanity. There's a very good YouTube of it, actually, Mr. Speaker, you see all of the bits of it being redone by National Geographic. This small movement, it is hardly Abu Simbel, but I think that it is important for our children that this particular building be preserved and that it be accessible to future generations of the Gibraltarians. Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Chief Minister, and I concur with you rather than having to do it myself. However, in this case, and I refer back to the Constitution, the Secretary of State in this House
not requiring the permission of the Secretary of State for anything that's going to be altered.
Whether this building is in fact on the Crown lands, and the provision I was referring to was in exactly that kind of instance, where this building is on Crown land and not government land, and therefore, to my reading of the law as it stands, any attempt to lift any building on Crown land would require the permission of the Secretary of State, which is why I included that in my question. It would have been possible, I don't know if it is possible, if the Minister had applied to the Secretary of State to list it in its current situation, and the Secretary of State was so minded that he may have adverted the need to move this building. But Mr. Speaker, I must ask the Minister, isn't that slightly concerned that this sets a rather dangerous precedent for any other structure or building which currently is on Crown or MOD land, for example, the last structure on Windmill Hill, which certainly are old and ancient, and whether the MOD stance would be, look, either we demolish it for car parking or take it away. And does the Minister have an intention of accelerating the heritage justice to cover this kind of scenario? And Mr. Speaker, there isn't one that doesn't quite understand the structure of land in Gibraltar. All land in Gibraltar is Crown land. Even freehold land is Crown land because the title comes from the Crown. The Crown, Mr. Speaker, is that Crown, the Crown that is here in Parliament. It is the Crown which is represented in Gibraltar by his Excellency the Government, the representation of Her Majesty the Queen of Gibraltar. And that Crown land is vested in the people of Gibraltar. The Ministry of Defence has access to it, whilst that land is necessary only for the purposes of the defence of Gibraltar. And so, Mr. Speaker, the Secretary of State is a tenant in respect of that land. And that is the clear position under something that is called Land Memoranda, which comes from the times of Dr. Hassan, and the negotiations have traditionally been on the basis that that is the case. And so, if that is Crown land, means nothing in the context of the situation, any more than that this is Crown land, that the Honourable Gentleman's apartment is on Crown land, and that all of us live on Crown land, because all these should come from the Crown in Gibraltar. Now, if there is an item of heritage value on land which is presently used by the Ministry of Defence, well, I think the Honourable Gentleman will find that most of what the Ministry of Defence inhabits has long been some of the most precious heritage that Gibraltar might have. And the Ministry of Defence are not known for looking after the heritage of Gibraltar. I mean, the work that the Honourable the Minister for Employment did when he was Minister for Education at the university, when he was responsible for that project, showed us that those magnificent facilities up there were often drilled into with no respect for the work that had begun in erecting those buildings, etc. I suppose it was the Ministry of Defence that said, the Royal Engineers threw that, and the Royal Engineers made a hole in it 400 years later, 250 years later. That's not quite what one would expect. And so, Mr. Speaker, I think it is important that we realise that in the context of this particular act, the Secretary of State had a role which was not a role related to where the land was. It was a role related to the 1969 Constitution and the structure of it. The 2006 Constitution is different, Mr. Speaker. All matters are left in the government, except for those carved out. Defence is one of the items carved out. And so, Mr. Speaker, matters relating to defence still will require consent of the Secretary of State, etc. I do not think it is appropriate to be asking Secretaries of State to owe their allegiance to another Crown, whether they would agree that something should be listed in the respective Crown land in Gibraltar. I think you will find that is an attitude that was shared across the floor with the former DOC administration, given his critical look, I don't know whether it's really shared today. And that is why, Mr. Speaker, the policy of this government has been to bring a heritage and integrity back, because we will do with that, as we will with many, many other things about standing in relation to heritage. I suppose, given that we're dealing with heritage and antiquity, it's right that these things should mature before they are brought to Parliament, and that's why it's taking a little time. Of course, it is obviously a choice whether one steps in to say this particular small guardhouse, or not, given that it could establish what the other government calls a precedent. The government doesn't see it as a precedent at all. There were other measures that could have been taken by the government, but I think in the context of what we're dealing with and the size of what we're dealing with, this is the right measure to have taken and to ensure that we can preserve this particular guardhouse for future generations in the way that we have. Each case we have to be dealt with in its merit, and here at the MOD they see this as a precedent. If they did, they would be foolish to do so, because the government has, and in future will have even more opportunities to take action to prevent Gibraltar's heritage from being dissipated in any way, wherever on the whole of the square miles of Gibraltar that heritage item may be located, all of it being crying out. Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Chief Minister for his presentation as to what is and what is not some land, and also his view to the role, if any, that any Secretary of State may or may not play. I have to remember that there is reference to the Secretary of State in the heritage of that, and the Minister can correct me if I'm wrong. And my question is, if the Chief Minister is adamant that we have total control over all land in Gibraltar, why was it that the government simply didn't lift the structure? Well, Mr. Speaker, I don't know the answer to that question, because we have to ask the Honourable, the former Leader of the House, who did an agreement in respect of that particular argument. And the agreement in relation to land done by the Ministry of Defence and the Gibraltar government, and the land agreement, as they are known, covered that guardhouse. And it was to come back to the government of Gibraltar, and then there would have been no issue, Mr. Speaker. But the Ministry of Defence had options under that agreement, and they exercised the option to retain that portion of land, and in the context of doing so, we find ourselves with this difficulty, Mr. Speaker. But I am heartened that honourable members are now encouraging us to pursue our policies in respect of heritage, because it was our policy to have a heritage and to do that. We are the ones working on it. They didn't have it in their manifesto. We are the ones pursuing this particular attitude, which will enable us to preserve the Baltic heritage. And I'm very much looking forward to the time when relevant ministers who've been working on this in great detail, from the Deputy Chief Minister to the Minister for the Environment and the Minister, the former Minister for Heritage, the Minister for Culture, bring that piece of legislation to the House, because I think it's an important step forward in the protection of the Baltic heritage, as indeed was the step taken by us in government, which was, I imagine, opposed by honourable members opposite, to have a Gibraltar archaeologist. Of course, that immensely increased the number of people in the public sector, something in which they repeatedly whip us. But all of this is part of the work of preserving our heritage. Can I just add one thing, Speaker? Were it not for the intervention of the Chief Minister and Derek O'Malley, that guardhouse would probably now be on the rubble dump, and that is one point that seems to have escaped your position.
Mr. Speaker, the former Minister will know, whether nobody in this house has been informed, or if he's told what he's got. And he wants congratulations, and I'll be very heartened strongly for him and the government and his sustained structure. But my concern, Mr. Speaker, is that we have to bring in law. The Chief Minister has just come straight length to tell us that he has full control of everything in Gibraltar, except for this guardhouse, it would appear. And when I asked him why wasn't the minister, he said, well, he doesn't know, because of his random. Now, which way is it? Does he have control of everything in Gibraltar, or does he not? And if he does, why didn't he lift it? Mr. Speaker, the other one is pretending that he and one particular set of people who have heritage close to the heart. He's wrong to do that. He doesn't realise how close to his heart the whole of the seven has our heritage. In fact, it's one of the reasons why many of us, in fact all of us on this side of the house, are in politics, to preserve our heritage and to take it forward for future generations. And heritage is not just building, it's a way of life, it's language,
is our commitment to British sovereignty. All of that, Mr. Speaker, is an important part of the heritage of Gibraltar. Although I hear the Honourable Leader of the Association of the different things for the rest of what he shouldn't be saying in this house. Now, Mr. Speaker, it's very clear to me, that the Albanese government doesn't seem to understand the structure of Gibraltar's piracy, political piracy.
I've explained in detail to him how the land memorandum over the years applied. I'm asking you not to repeat it. If he hasn't understood what the explanation that you have given, it's just too bad. But I'm asking you not to repeat it. You have explained what the position is with regard to Crown land, whether it's held by the Ministry of Defence or by the government of Gibraltar. It is a matter going back for decades, which previous chief ministers have fought very, very hard to obtain. You have explained what the position is. Please don't repeat it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And the point is, Mr. Speaker, that the upshot of all that, and I guess I'll say it clearly enough that you are right to tell me not to repeat it again, is that the government of Gibraltar controls all land in Gibraltar. Now, the Constitution provides certain exceptions. Defence, Mr. Speaker, is the relevant one here, defence and security. And if a piece of land is required for defence purposes, then it is not an area that we control, and we can see what happens there. But there are other opportunities to control what happens in the respect of that area of land, Mr. Speaker. And the Honourable Gentleman just needs to read the newspaper and see what happens last week to see that the jurisdiction of the voter extends to what is occurring on MOD land. That is, I think, now more abundantly clear than it ever has been before. So, Mr. Speaker, I'm surprised that he is still insisting in respect to this matter. But look, there was a small guardhouse. It had heritage value. We have saved that guardhouse. It is going to be preserved for future generations. It is going to be rebuilt elsewhere, which it should not have to be rebuilt elsewhere, but it could have stayed there. Perhaps a more sensible approach might have been possible. I am sorry to say, it was not possible, Mr. Speaker. Could we have done something else in respect of a land which has heritage value on MOD, on the MOD estate? I have already told them that there are other opportunities to do things in respect of such heritage artifacts, and in fact, there will be even more under the new heritage and antiquity act. Now, other than going around in circles and explaining it all to him again, which is super in fact, good, I am not able to do, I would just perhaps ask him to take a closer look at the provisions of the Gibraltar Constitution and how it changed since 1961.
Question 121. I'm going to give an opportunity to the Honourable Lawrence Yamas to ask a number of supplementary arising from the schedule that were previously circulated. Yes, I'll allow you before we move on to him. Yes. So, looking forward, is it the position of the government when it publishes the New Heritage Act that it has the constitutional power and indeed the will to be able to list any historical document, any historical building, I beg your pardon, within the MOD land, so that those are preserved and protected against any adverse decisions by the MOD in the future?
Mr. Speaker, I would take that question to have been uttered with an element of oral negligence, because the Honourable Gentleman does not need me to tell him, I hope, that an act of Parliament cannot change the Constitution. So we are not going to change the constitutional position by an act of Parliament. And if he sees the way that he phrased this question in hindsight, he will realise that he has suggested that in the way he has put it. Of course, an act is not going to change the constitutional position, but the act will make the most of the constitutional authority available to the government in those particular respects. But look, it is also true to say, Mr. Speaker, it is also true to say that we are talking here about the antiquity of the MOD to a small guardhouse and all the rest of it, but we have to set this debate in the context of where Gibraltar has been in the last 20 years and where it is today. In particular, it was not the Ministry of Defence that destroyed the Rose of Tanks, the tanks that victualled the victory on its way to the Battle of Trafalgar. It was those who were in the party that said it had pirated close to its heart. We've come a long way since then. We're going to go even further. We're going to protect Gibraltar for future generations. This government has done a sterling job already in doing so. We will do even better in the future.
Honourable Gentleman and his unfortunate usual style of attempting to obfuscate questions and indeed the answers that he gives. The question is very simple. Does the government feel confident that the new Heritage Act will be able to prevent the destruction of Gibraltar's heritage even when it is on MOD land, so that we don't have a repetition of what has happened with the government?
Mr. Speaker, this is what happens when honourable members don't listen to all of the answers that have been provided. I've said yes on a number of occasions in answer to his honourable colleague. I say yes again to him, given that he appears to only understand things which are black or white, yes or no. The answer is yes, and he should not think that we don't, under the existing act, potentially also have powers in that respect, because that, and look at what I said in Hanford, and don't go back and look at my chairlessly phrased his earlier question, and he'll be able to see what I said. And Peter, I wasn't obfuscating when I was referring to the Rose attempt, I was referring to the destruction of them by the GOD. So it ill behoves them to say that they are the ones who hold heritage close to their hearts, unless their hearts are in a heap of rubble.
Younger religion.
So the speaker is going to question 103. One of two relates to a question last year, 847-2016, where there is a considerable amount of capital work being carried out by existing infrastructure. Now, the breakdown of the number of minutes has been, it's very brief and it doesn't actually concur with the capital work that actually appears to have been taking place in each concern. I wonder if maybe he's been getting the wrong breakdown.
What I have noticed is that there's only the cost given in one of the entries, it may be that the version that was included may have been an earlier draft, but I undertake to look into this today and just to cross-check whether there has been some error in the preparation or in the table that has actually been presented. I apologize for that. I will look into that and ensure that we have enough results.
And also, it would be helpful if the Honourable Minister could include the years in which the works took place at the moment. It's going to be an outline of the month and end month, but we don't know if it's a year or just. Also, turning to question number 110 of 2017, is the Honourable Minister able to provide further details as to what type of arrears other areas are owed by the debtors to the government, whether tax, rent, rate, or any other type of arrears?
In relation to question? Speaker, my impression from the question from the answer that has been prepared for me is that there are none, but once again, as he has asked that, I will double check specifically.
So, Mr. Speaker, am I right to assume that the only way that these companies have, or entities in general, are in relation to the upper of admission fees, and you don't have any other arrears with another government department? So that's what I think is confusing. You don't send out the arrears in other departments or other government owned companies.
Because that is what I said I believe to be the case. But as the Honourable Member is asking specifically, as I don't prepare the draft of the answer to information myself, I will go back to the Speaker and the Service to double check that my impression is correct, and I will respond.
And finally, Mr. Speaker, in relation to question 107, the Honourable Minister said that the question of the taxi drivers is not coming in the month of January and February, is because it's a low season. Can I just ask the Minister, given that just using taxi registers, the taxi would have been given an exemption from not paying they've had an increase from, if you take April to January 1516 and April to January 1617, they've had an increase of passengers of 117,000. But it seems further exempted by not paying for those 2 months.
If the other members are referring to the fact that it seems to have increased this last winter as opposed to the previous one, is that what you're saying?
So, comparing the figures from April 15 to January 16, and then comparing them from April 16 to January 17, because of obviously the new policy from not allowing the foreign vehicles up the road, taxi drivers, as well as other tour operators, have benefited from an increase of 117 just for those months. So it appears that, you know, they could have made up for those 2 months which were previously exempted, and to allow them to further exempt for this year. It doesn't seem fair when we've got, for example, the Chief Minister asking in his budget in his new issue that we should, this is a time now of common work and endeavour. So it doesn't seem to tie in with what the Chief Minister is trying to tell the community to further exempt from other people low season for many services and many.
So, the speaker, I think the Honourable Gentleman will understand what the provision does. It takes more people up to work, which means more people access the tourist site. So, it is driving more traffic into the upper rock and therefore enabling us to have more revenue. Because otherwise, people might have not, in those months, been prepared to go up at the ticket price. They are prepared to go up. And some of them, when they're up there, will go into the site and will then purchase the ticket. So we have a different view as to what it is like for the government side of the equation. Although, because there may be revenue generally, we think that this helps an industry, and that industry is also a part of what keeps the boat running. I mean, I know that honourable members like to whip the taxi drivers as much as they can, but they're an important sector of our economy as well. And they do, in their own way, produce economic activity. And we happen to think that this is economic activity that has to be fostered, even in months and otherwise, it would be difficult to see them able to do other types of business that would keep us safe.
Question number 121, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the Minister for Education provide an update on its commitment to provide hot school lunches to all children in our schools?
The Speaker, Government. Sorry, I haven't been called, so can I let you call me? Sorry, I'm a little enthusiastic this morning.
I'll say the Honourable the Minister for Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, Government is working on delivering on our commitment.
Mr. Speaker, it would be helpful if the Minister could give a little bit of more information on that. But we, last September 15th of September last year, we were told that the government was preparing for a consultation process with parents, head teachers and their unions. And in the Chief Minister's New Year message, he said, and you can use that word in here, shortly we'll be launching the programme for hot launches to be available in schools. So I would be grateful if the Minister could amplify his answer to provide our community with a bit more oversight as to what is happening.
But Mr. Speaker, the consultation process is ongoing.
I would be grateful to know at what stage the consultation process is. We were told that there was planning or pre-planning and preparation for the consultation process. Is the consultation process underway? Has the department spoken to parents, head teachers, and their unions? The consultation process is sufficiently advanced, and I am very confident that in the next election, honourable members will not be able to tell the electorate that we failed in our commitment to provide hot lunches to all our children in the school.
Question number 122, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education provide an update on the building of 5 new schools, namely the new Bishop of Scales, Rotterdam, St. Martin's, Bayside, and St. Anne's schools, and the projected cost of the undertaking?
Council, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The Speaker, a working group has been set up to include all the head teachers and deputy heads of the personal schools and also senior staff from the Department of Education to deal with the work to be undertaken. It is still not possible to talk about any meaningful projected costs beyond ballpark figures.
Is the Minister able to give us a ballpark figure?
No, Mr. Speaker. I think this person is normally used to say approximate estimate. Mr. Speaker, I would rather not at this stage.
Question number 123, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government confirm whether or not the Department of Education, either directly or indirectly, invited school children as young as 6 years of age and above to send letters to the United States President Donald Trump congratulating and welcoming him to his office?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 130.
Question number 130, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassanan.
Can the Minister for Education explain the process relating to the possibility for third parties or external bodies to have an influence on the school agenda, as was seen with the recent Donald Trump competition exercise to Anthem?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Speaker, in the specific case referred to, the competition is organised by the American Chamber of Commerce, and schools were offered the opportunity to participate. It is not for the Department of Education to consider who the incumbent president is, but rather to consider the educational value of such a competition. No third party has any influence on the school agenda. The Department of Education decides on which competitions have educational value. It then invites schools to decide if they want to participate or not. Schools have complete autonomy to decide if they want to take part. I'm now going to quote from a letter written by a 7-year-old Syrian girl who introduces herself to President Trump as, and I quote, part of the Syrian children who suffered from the Syrian war. And the quote continues, can you please save the children and people of Syria? You must do something for the children of Syria because they are like your children and deserve peace like you. And the letter then continues, if you promise me you will do something for the children of Syria, I am already your new friend. The relevant people penned this letter just before Donald Trump's inauguration speech, and I do not feel I have to add anything else.
One further question relating to that. Given that we are an open, tolerant community, could the Minister explain the educational value of this competition, particularly for those as young as six?
I think it's not the Minister has no responsibility on educational grounds to explain the competition set up by a third party. No.
Okay, Mr. Speaker, what he did explain that the Department of Education would assess the educational value.
Mm-hmm. You are asking the Minister to explain, in his view, what the educational value is of a particular competition which has been introduced by a third party. The Minister, as a responsible Minister of the Water Government, has no responsibility and has no, there is no requirement for him to express such a view.
Mr. Speaker, much as I am warmed by the Minister's quote of the Syrian girls, I think that the desperation of the Syrians and the Syrian cause cannot really be paralleled with our own motives and our own values in an open and democratic community. So perhaps I think that the two things are very different, and obviously considering the doubts and the issues that many free-thinking people have with Trump's presidency, I think this is what we were coming to mainly in terms of doubting whether, in my case, my question was more about how the Ministry of Education decides on what actually has value and what our interest is when we hand over to our children to make such representations.
Well, I don't think it behoves any
the government of one state to be commenting on the government of another state unless they are going to engage in diplomacy in respect of one aspect or another. But I can think that there is potentially huge educational value in asking our children to write to the leadership of North Korea that yesterday discharged a missile into the Sea of Japan, whilst it tests its nuclear-equipped warheads and the ability to deliver those warheads across the Pacific into North America. And to write to him to ask him to help to keep the world a more peaceful place. I can imagine that there is huge educational value in asking our children to write to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom to ask her to put EU nationals who live in the UK out of their misery as to what their rights will be in respect of residents in the UK once the United Kingdom leaves the European Union. There are many things in which we all, or some of us individually, might agree or disagree with an international politician, where an exercise in the tools of writing to that individual may bring out of the children something as moving as the Honourable Gentleman has referred to us in respect of this story. And there, I was really moved when I saw what the Honourable Gentleman had now referred to the House, and it was referred to me. And it will put me in mind of the fact that exercises like this can have consequences which we can't imagine. And sometimes the 6-year-olds can make something really shine out in that way. Mr. Trump has been vilified in the international press for many reasons. A lot of what he reads is anathema to modern liberal democracy. Some of what you say we might all agree with. I mean, the Washington Post has lower corporate taxes. The President of the United States is saying he wants to lower corporate taxes in the United States. And a lot of people think that we are a pariah internationally because we have low corporate rates. He is going to do that. He is going to, as he said, move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, something that causes huge controversy but is positive in the view in the mind of others. So I think that this is not about making a judgment about Donald Trump. I think each of us are entitled as human beings to make a judgment, even about politicians we don't vote for, but who we read about. But this is an exercise, I think, run in good faith by an organization that wants the people to be educationally involved in writing a letter. I think it would have been run whether Mrs. Clinton had won the election or Mr. Trump had won the election. And therefore, we have to be careful not to sway into making our own views and choices what we impose on children in the way that they might not have had the opportunity of writing a letter. I can imagine that many of those 6-year-olds, apart from the two and their might have given Mr. Trump very good advice indeed. And if only we could get him to read those letters, it might be that our own liberal views as to what could happen in the United States might prevail. But unfortunately, that's not the way the world crumbles. But I do wish that Mr. Trump would have the advice to make this little civil day and do and go to his friends by doing what she does to do. Mr. Speaker, if I may ask the Minister of Education, given that his department obviously endorsed this competition and continues to do so, how many schools actually are participating? And of that population of schools, how many didn't participate? And why? Mr. Speaker, I believe I'm working from memory that 8 schools have participated, but I would need to check them. I'd be grateful if we would check that indeed 8 schools did participate. Out of the population of how many? Given number of schools. There are 7 first schools more or less 11, 12. I mean that is okay. I would like to know why certain schools do not participate. I'm going to speak up. I said before, schools have total autonomy in whether they feel that that the school program allows them to do this or whether they want to. And this and any other initiative of the state, so I cannot ask for account. The head teachers have a considerable amount of autonomy, and I think that is absolutely correct.
The House. I mean, one of the things the Honourable Gentleman and Lady Everett might be even more intense at is that the magnificent
pupils of the Mary's Middle School, opposite number 6 for Common Day. So Mary's first school, not opposite number 6 for Common Day, decided to invite the chief minister to go, a man with whom they have no affinity whatsoever, who they regard probably as a lower form of political life than even the President of the United States, to come in, and they've done magnificent work to understand the politics of the vote, the painted portraits of all the chief ministers, yourself included, Mr. Speaker, and they were very interested in what it is that a chief minister does, and they gave me elements of advice as to what it is that a chief minister should be doing and what the best thing for the voter might be in the future. None of them, by the way, had any affinity with any of the enjoyable members of the government to be for the voter future. But look, nobody told that school to do it. Nobody told them to invite me to go and meet the voters and bias them in some way in favour of my political party. Nobody told the other schools to do it. They thought there was educational value in that, and yet I know honourable members, in fact, the honourable Mr. Yannick said that I have embarked with also in a school by train to ruin. So one would have thought it's something that they would have wanted to curtail. Although he only asked questions in this house, I say as an aside, that relates to hoverboards, Mr. Speaker. So maybe it's that he thinks that I put us in a segue to ruin, but his questions really don't reflect that level of serious concern about where our community goes. Schools need to have the freedom to do what they think is educationally in the best interest of their pupils and the us. They do. This offer is made to them. We don't stand in the way of it. And some of them produce magnificent results by the results of their reception to this time.
Mr. Speaker, if I may add to that, regarding international value, education.
Yes, ma'am.
Can we return now to the question rather than the Chief Minister's sort of visit? Interesting as that is to say Mary's school, and I do have a supplementary, and that is relevant. We've now gone from the Minister to the Chief Minister back to the Chief to the Minister.
Well, from the Minister, it will go to you.
So this is anecdotal, but there has been a question about the educational value, and I was about to say that my own grandson. May I not inquire about the educational value?
You may not express, because you are not a professional,
No. You
are politically responsible for education in the voter, but you are not a professional. I am holding that you are not required to answer a question as to what you deem to be the educational value of the exercise.
That
is my ruling.
My response at the time is going to be exactly that. I was very grateful to Mr. Speaker for having gone to the right. But then I will ask not as an educational professional, but as a grandparent whose 5-year-old grandson, my little Ryan, who I've never spoken to about Donald Trump before, asked me the other day. I said to him about nature, birds, and Pokemon, but not about Donald Trump. And he just took the election, said, "Grandpa, I hear Donald Trump got made president of the United States. Are you happy about that?" I won't say what the answer was, but clearly they are aware about these things, and there is clearly education value in them having a discussion about this subject. That's purely the grandfather and not as an educational professional, which I am not.
Well, thank you very much to the Minister for answering the question that from my honourable friend, Mr. Phillips, that was ruled out. My question is about policy. I mean, you know, here we have a situation where you have a private entity that is channeled through the Department of Education an initiative. Now, the Department of Education has obviously endorsed that initiative and has indeed affected the strategy for the implementation of the initiative. When an initiative like that comes to the Department of Education, does the Minister actually get consulted in relation to this, or is it a decision that is taken entirely by the Department of Education and the Minister is not involved in any consultative capacity at all?
As a rule, educational professionals deal with it in a professional manner. If there are any issues in which the Department of Education feels that are issues that need to be discussed at another level, then they may come to me. Remember, Mr. Speaker, that I have only been Minister of Education for a relatively short time. I can only assume that was the practice in the past.
Well, in relation to this,
I do apologize. My response is normally, this is an educational matter, you have to take a view on the educational value, and this is not a political matter. This is my usual response to that sort of request.
And in relation to this particular instance, this particular instance, was the minister consulted before it was effective?
Yes, I was informed about the matter and I referred it to the system. Referred it to the system for an opinion again.
Question number 124, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state the number of exchanges that have taken place between the University of Gibraltar and other universities and colleges?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, if this is an independent body, that question should be addressed to the university.
Mr. Speaker, thanks for taking the view. In your manifesto, Mr. Speaker, in the government's manifesto, there's a reference to university exchanges being applaud the Washington internship. They state quite categorically that they would improve exchanges between the university and other universities, which I mean like a foreign university. There is, Mr. Speaker, a financial commitment of over £10 million to establish the university, and there's a continuing obligation of the government to support the university, and yet the university is not self-sufficient. I would have thought it's within the purview of the minister to answer the question as to the number of exchanges. I'm quite happy to write to the Chancellor, but Mr. Speaker, in relation to this matter, this is a funded project by the people, by the public, and from the public purse. It's over £10 million, it continues to be funded. But I would have thought that they could explain a very simple answer to that question, which is how many exchanges have taken place between the university and other external universities.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable General raises an issue of principle. We fund a lot of things that are independent. So, Mr. Speaker, one of the things that the Honourable, the former Chief Minister, very often asserted as the greatest civil servant of all time, insisted in the course of the debate in this House when we created the university was that it must be independent. And the hindsight is there. I mean, the Honourable General said in relation to the bank and in relation to that, to the university, I'm going to support the arrangement, but it must be entirely independent. And so, when we as a matter of policy, Mr. Speaker, want to see things happen, we write and we provide funding, and then it is a matter for the university. And we are not politically answerable in the past for things that are independent, because if we were, it would be impossible for us to provide information without compromising independence. And so, the Honourable Gentleman has the answer to his question, which is that he should write to the Vice Chancellor.
Question number 125, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassanon.
How many teaching posts are currently vacant and being active?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, just to prove that when I can provide information and when it's appropriate, as I said, I will do the information requested by the Honourable Member is in the schedule I now. And over.
Mr. Speaker, does the Minister accept that there is a backlog and delays in appointing the right candidates to these posts, and does he have plans to bring these backlogs down and up to date as it is disconcerting for teachers and pupils?
Mr. Speaker, there are a total of 18 posts out of a complement of 382 teachers, so that's only 4.7%. It is low. Clearly, we would like all the teachers to be there in the substantive position, but sometimes that isn't possible, particularly because of the disruption that can be caused for a movement of teachers in the middle of the academic year. So I would be concerned if this was the case, or there were higher levels. This is actually quite low, but if there were higher levels at the beginning of the academic year. I'm not so concerned about halfway into the academic year, because the plan is to regularize them all by September, so there can be some, so that most of them will be still in September. I think it's a time of year that is more relevant than in any particular moment.
Sorry, I don't quite understand. So is the intention to, because I also have noticed that a lot of posts do get taken over at the middle of the academic year, and I have noticed that it can look a little bit clumsy. So is the intention to have them all set up by September?
It's bigger. The intention is to have them all by September. Clearly, there may be other things that happen between now and September, people retiring, people going sick for long term, and so on and so forth. It doesn't mean that there won't be any changes during the academic year, particularly in some of the senior posts, which might be necessary. But that is a management decision, and it is up to the senior staff of the education department to manage them as they see it fitting best with the schools, and they do this in discussion with the schools, with head teachers, and as part of the social partnership with the teachers association in discussion with the GPA.
Question number 126, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Sanon.
How are the vacant positions of education advisors in the Department of Education being covered at present, and what plans, if any, are there to fill them?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The speaker, in order, again, not to disrupt the functioning of our school, the posts are being covered by experienced retired head teachers and deputy head teachers. There are, however, clear and well-defined plans to fill in these posts in the immediate future, and most certainly before the end of this academic year, in accordance with the government's manifesto commitment.
Mr. Speaker, would the minister agree that the fact that retired teachers are presently doing this work is actually denying present teachers of having experience and action in these roles? And does the minister agree that this also affects the current teachers' hopes and motivations to an extent?
First of all, I would like to thank these retired teachers for coming back and serving the community in the way that they are and using their vast experience in education in serving the gap. I can assure the Honourable Lady that this matter is in the process of being addressed actively and very, very shortly. We will be able to allow these head teachers and deputy head teachers the rest and recovery that retirement needs to bring, and we will have teachers replacing them in their place. Mr. Speaker, by September, once again, the relevance of disrupting the school comes into play, and by September, they will be in place.
Mr. Speaker, I made a supplementary ask the Minister. And these retired head teachers, deputy head teachers, on what basis are they being put away on some kind of compulsory agreement, or is it simply the extension of the normal employment contract?
Mr. Speaker, I would need to seek the information. They were there well before I took over responsibility for education, and therefore it is not information that I have to hand, but I am very happy to find out.
Question number 127, the Honourable Ms. Andy Sanyan.
Has an adequate audit been carried out in recent years to ascertain present levels of heating in classrooms in our schools?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, an intensive present safety audit was undertaken in schools during 2012, which included an assessment of temperature control. The findings indicated that building insulation, cross ventilation, and numerous other contributing factors have an impact on counteracting temperature extremes. Classroom temperatures are checked on a regular basis and flagged if they drop beneath what is considered a healthy working environment. Action to remedy this situation is then taken.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for that answer, but does the us to realize that many classrooms in our schools are actually not properly equipped within our teaching, to the extent that teachers are having to bring in their own portable heaters on occasions. May this indicate other problems?
I'm not aware of teachers bringing in their own heaters, if that is the case, that certainly hasn't been brought to my notice, and it's certainly something that should not be necessary, because I'm sure that the Department of Education would be more than happy to provide any additional heaters should they be required. But I think this government has accepted the fact that some of our schools are now tired, and this is why we have this program that we're embarking to replace some of the schools. Without the detailed information here present, I suspect that the ones where this might, where temperature control might be more of a problem, will be the older ones, and these are the ones that we are planning to replace.
Okay, can I ask the other lady, because what you said is very concerning. And can I ask the other lady to give the government information of which classrooms are going to be there? Is being employed that is happening so that we can act to the Department of Education, because it's shocking to hear that. And nobody has brought that to the attention of the government. We hear the same rumours that the Honourable Lady hears, but this one we haven't heard. If it's more than a rumour and we have information, please tell us which schools, which classrooms, and we will immediately attempt to deal with it, because the way the new schools are going to be developed, we will have a period of time between. Now and then new classrooms, and we don't want anybody to be told in the context of that period of time. I know the Honourable Minister for Education is also the Minister for the Environment, and that is causing some friction with the view of global warming. But it's important that we do it.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Chief and Family Minister for Education for these answers and for their concerns. I can assure them that it's not rumours, and I will be providing information so that they can deal with this matter. In fact, I was, before the Chief Minister said, I was going to ask, and I'm grateful to see that that the government will address this issue for what's left of the winter months, at least to make sure that children are adequately heated. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, absolutely.
Question number 128, Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Nam.
Can the Minister for Education give any information on how far the co-education working group has come to date, and if any recommendations have already been made to government?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the co-education working group continues to work adhering to its duties. It has as yet made no recommendations to government and will not be doing so until the end of April or early May. The task is too important to rush through. I am, however, completely assured that steady progress has been made. In fact, Mr. Speaker, I believe that the working group is meeting again today.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Honourable Minister for his answer. But my understanding is this working group is meant to report by the end of March. I can simply have to the fact that the brief period is now being extended.
Mr. Speaker, I'm in close contact with the Acting Director of Education on this. The work has generated a lot of interest, a lot of submissions, so I think that we would rather be cautious and suggest that it may slip by a month or possibly two. We're still hopeful that we will meet the March target, but we are being realistic.
Question number 129, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Nam.
In connection with the student grants, can government confirm that they are up to date with repayments to the UK student loan company to cover grant repayments?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, of course we are.
Mr. Speaker, I can assure you this is not rumour. But is the Minister for Education not aware that the UK student loan company has been taking payments of the loan from graduates, claiming that government has not paid them in over a year?
No, Mr. Speaker, once again, it is not rumour, and then it's serious, and we would like to know. This information has not come to me.
if it's not rumor, there must be something in writing. If there is something in writing, we must have it immediately, because we will demonstrate to whoever is receiving your own company is chasing that the payments are made more than on time. And I urge the Honourable Lady, this is a very serious allegation, to let us have the written evidence that this is not rumor, that somebody has been faced for a payment so that we can deal with it immediately. Especially if it relates to a simple-term budget, or even worse, somebody who is currently in education. And I'd be particularly concerned about somebody who is a student being chased in this respect, and we will be able to demonstrate that all payments are done more than on time in respect of all accounts. Because you know, this is one of the most important areas of development for the government, as the Honourable Lady knows. We are committed to further education. We are committed in particular to people being able to go away and study also their second degrees. We would not have put in place the system that was put in place in respect of student loans, perhaps, because it was something that the GSC did when they were in government, and we have honoured it.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Chief Minister's concern, but I fail to accept that the only form of negating a rumor is written evidence. I have very concerned graduates who have put some concerns because there are very urgent pleas for them to pay back, and they have come to me in tears, so I don't have a written evidence. I also have been asked not to say by name, but I'm happy to speak to the Chief Minister in private about this matter, because I can assure him that it's a matter that is very much alive.
Consider this is very strange. The Student Loans Company is a government-owned company in the UK. Now, some members of it continually say that the UK is going to go bankrupt, and all that nonsense, that is not true. Nobody says the UK is going to go bankrupt, and the student loan company in the UK therefore has to call people to chase into payments. The student loan company sends letters and emails when people do not meet their obligations to repay. They do not call people. And speaking, they I didn't know where the payments come from, so if there were any concern, they would have been directed at us. And everyone needs to be sure that what she is saying is very concerning for the community. She needs to be sure that what she is saying is that the student loan company is facing people for payment. Now, I must tell the Honourable Lady, and she knows I have a huge amount of time for her, but she must realize that if somebody has called her crying because her payment has not been made by the government of Gibraltar, she should not put down a question 7 days ago and not raise it until we get up and in a supplementary telegram. Because if somebody is crying because the government hasn't made the payments, something's fallen down. I assure her this is not happening. But if the government thinks it's made a payment and it's gone to the wrong account, the government doesn't delay making payments which are due in respect of loans. Everything is paid ahead of the date when it has to be paid. Then she should have brought it to my attention and taken it with the greatest of respect, or indeed to the attention of Mr. Kotick. She knows that we would, of course, immediately have dealt with the issue. I seriously doubt that there is a problem relating to a government payment here. And that's why I've said to the Honourable Lady, although of course there are different ways of dealing with rumour, which is not to have written evidence that counteracts the rumour. I know I've spent most of my days dealing with rumours, and one has to counteract them in different ways. But if it's the student loan company, and that's what she's referred us to, they would take by letter and by email. That would be specifically that it's like, these are not loan staff, Mr. Speaker, who will get together and tell somebody and come and break their legs if they don't make a payment. This is the United Kingdom Student Loan Company. And therefore, it's like, that was banned, because like Barclays Bank, they will be sending correspondence chasing unpaid accounts, in particular graduate unpaid accounts. And that is what I'm saying to the Honourable Lady. She needs to tell us that we have failed to do in order to give any credence to what she's saying. There have been problems in historically, Mr. Speaker, with making payments in respect of people's prison fees. I know because I have suffered that. I've been at university, I've been told the Department of Education hasn't paid your tuition fees. Now, that's bad in the early 1990s, too long ago for me to care to remember, before the Department of Education. And it's always the same. The university tells you they haven't paid. You phone the Department of Education, and the Department of Education, who are magnificent at dealing with these issues, whoever has been in administration will say, we are waiting for the university to give us this detail in their bank account, we are waiting for the university to provide this certification, etc.,
Department of Education, failing in its mechanism for payment in respect of disabilities, in respect of maintenance grants, or in respect of the mechanism put in place by the former administration, I was tempted to say by then when we were in government, but it's beyond the lady, I think, so by the former administration, to pursue student loans, something which I think was the wrong thing to do, but all of those payments are made entirely on time, and you must not think that there's any government issue in that respect, and that's why I've asked for the written evidence, because it must be in writing if this payment is.
The process, as I understand, is that the students sign the agreement with the devoted government or with the student loan company. So somehow the student loan company in the UK has the information of the student. Now, eventually, when according to the student loan company who called, they say that they are saying what they said, that they have not got any payment and are fed up with saving the government, and this is why they have turned to students and in fact even threatened to take the money out of their bank accounts if apparently they're entitled to do as per UK law. I am somebody who, and many of the ministers will know that I always try and speak to them before bringing anything to Parliament. That's the way I work. But in these cases, interesting thing is that since I've asked the question, I've had two more graduates walked up in me telling me that they are actually also in the same position. In these cases, these people are begging me not to say their names because they're actually really scared of the repercussions. I'm not suggesting that there would be any repercussions. I am not suggesting for a minute. I am just holding the word to not say their names or to not go. So I can't go to government with these individual cases. I'm only bringing, they're not rumors, they're real people, but I have to hold their word and I have to respect their wishes, which is why I can't go directly to government, and this is why I brought it up as a generic question in Parliament. And this is where it is, and I will be happy to discuss it, but I cannot mention any names, because I have to respect the wishes.
But they can hold directly to the Department of Education, can't they? Or are they prohibited in the UK from writing to the Department of Education?
Okay,
this is very important. That we're able to respect. But if I may, with respect, the Honourable Lady has said that the student loan company has the student information. She's absolutely right. The student loan company has the student information because the structure that was put in place by the former administration, which we have discontinued, as I understand it, the federal reason for football, I think we've discontinued it, is that the student takes a loan in his name. And the government undertakes to pay. Right? That's how it works. Now, if the Honourable Lady won't tell us who these people are, and there's no fear of repercussions, if these are people who have not notified the department of their loan, we may not know that there's an outstanding. But if they also now don't allow us to have information as to who they are, we won't be able to make good the outstanding. No, Mr. Speaker, sir, Mr. Speaker, I think this is very important.
With respect to the Chief Minister,
I don't want to be really. I would not have seen, I would not have thought it, why I would have to take this step. So I'd rather, at the time of the not focusing on the focus on honorable members related to the state of the Can I implore you for one moment? There's no handset or in camera. If there's no microphone on, you're in camera. You have to be careful. The camera is on, you don't have to worry, the camera is on me because my microphone is on. But at least one microphone should be on for the purposes of the historic record of what you're about to say. Even if it's the clock microphone or something like that.
I'm on camera. I cannot understand why here in Parliament, with 17 people who are very busy, plus the class and so on, should be having to debate what is, in essence, a simple issue. And something that all of us who have been students over the last 50 or 60 years may have, at one time or another, had a similar experience of. Now, what does one do when it's either the climate isn't as it used to be, or these people get in touch? If you have a problem, you get in touch with the Department of Education in Gibraltar, and I'm sure the experience of most of us is that they would deal with the problem fairly quickly. So why do we have to keep on talking about a straightforward matter?
Speaker, if I may, thank you. Could I ask the government to get directly in touch as soon as possible with the UK Student Grant Company and Student Loans Company and ask them what is in fact going on and why they're calling graduates and sparing them?
This is why I'm afraid that I have to remind her of what the process was. The students are the principal obliger in those roles, right? And this was structured by the former administration in that way, and the government is not visible to the student loans company. They don't see us in the equation. I don't know whether it is an important money to the student for him to pay or direct to the student loans company, but they have no relationship with us. And if they did, the whole thing would be undone because there's an interest rate which is paid only to students, or period where it's paid only to students. It must have been that the former administration was running out of money, Mr. Speaker, because I don't understand how it is that we put Gibraltarian students in a situation where we force them to take loans. We force them to take loans, which then affected their ability to take other borrowing, Mr. Speaker, because when you come to your first mortgage, age 23, you're asked, do you owe anything? And you do, because the student loan company is still owed money that the government of Gibraltar is paying under a structure which they set up, and we have completely abandoned. That's why I'm saying to the Honourable Lady that we have no visibility to that, and the student loan company would not be able to talk to us about it. If we picked up the phone and said, it is the government of Gibraltar, can you please tell us what Gibraltarian students owe you that they haven't paid because we want to pay? They would say, look, this is a banking relationship. We cannot give you the information. We can't talk to you about the place of residence of people that owe us money or anything. A bit like what I have to say about credit finance or Honourable Members, they're right. So it is impossible for us, and my level of agitation is concerned that if it is true that this is happening, and they don't share the information with us, as Mr. Speaker said, it is impossible for us to rectify. And the last thing I want is for anybody who is a Gibraltar graduate or a Gibraltar undergraduate to be in that situation. But we want to be able to fix it. Now, I don't know how, if the other lady doesn't want to give us the name, how we deal with it, but please tell them to get in touch with the Department of Education, because if there were one outstanding, this would jump up like a red flag and hit the minister, and the minister would hit me with it. And there is, as far as the government is concerned, absolutely nothing outstanding to any UK Institute of Education, or to the UK Student Loan Company, in respect of any amount that are due by any Gibraltarian student. If there are, we need to know, and quickly, but if they don't tell us, we cannot rectify it.
Thank you for that, Chief Minister. But then, is the Chief Minister saying that they have no measure of communication, nothing at all? So, how over the years when do these things get paid back? And I understand.
Because there is a contract, and this is something that the party superintendent at the general election put in place, and we thought was a very bad thing. There is a contract between the student and the student loan company, which the students were forced to enter into by the GOC administration. That is a UK contract, a UK contract. And the government of Gibraltar has a contract with the student to pay back the amount that the student has taken in respect of their loan, in respect of whatever limit it was that might have been agreed at the time that the former administration was in government. That's the way it works. It's very strange. It's something that we spoke against from opposition. It's something that they thought was a very good idea because it gave the students money without the money having to something the government is involved with. Because it was another way of bumping up the scholarships in a particular way. I thought it was a very bad thing. It pushed students together with a Thatcherite approach to making students have to have those loans. The Stephen Rose Company is a feature of the Thatcher administration in the UK, and therefore this did not meet with our approval from opposition, and when we came into government, we stopped it. But there is zero relationship. There is zero legal contractual relationship between the government of Gibraltar and the student loan company. The GSB forced that it should be the student that should be the pivot in between both, and so the payments are made through the student to the student loan company. And if they don't tell us what amounts are outstanding, then we can't pay them. Now, I don't know whether it is that the former administration agreed a limit of the amount that students can take as student loans. And whether some people have taken more than that limit, and therefore this is their personal liability, that may be the case. But without the data, we are not able to provide that information. And that chasing, Mr. Speaker, would be something that would happen in writing, at least initially. Now, if the student loans company has assigned the debt, or the chasing of the debt, to an external credit agency, that would be months after the debt had been chased in writing. And if there hadn't been a repayment, if there's anything like this, the oral chasing that the other lady is talking about, it would be months after we've been chased in writing. And it would start to affect people's credit worthiness. That's why I'm very concerned about it. But if we don't have the information, we can't ensure that we rectify, and we can't ensure that we look at what it is that's happened. And it may be that in the setting up of these structures at the time that they were in government, something has fallen down in respect of these individuals, two or three individuals that she's talking about, but it's not something that's happening across the board. Far from it, as far as I'm concerned, this is a nightmare for students who were forced into debt by the GSB that is being resolved because we're not continuing to do it and we're making all the repayments as and when required.
Thank you, Susan. I repeat my concern was mainly because these individuals told me that the student loan company had told them that they were fired as finance director for the Department of Education, but I will come back to you and furnish you with as much information as I am at liberty to furnish you in order to take this matter out. Thank you.
Question number 131, the Honourable MD Hassan Naum.
Now that the new Minister of Education has had a chance to familiarise himself with the Ministry of Education, is he able to state what the main priorities are within the Voices Education Department in the post-Brexit era?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. But in order to pay on the inevitable supplementary, I am not going to today. I am able to, but I am not going to be questioning that government priorities are laid out in the budget speech, and I still have a little bit of work to do on that, so these will be very clear in my budget speech, which is after all just a few months ago.
Question 134, it's the Honourable Alex Yaman.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state which tourist information offices are currently run and which ones have been discontinued during the past 5 years?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, tourist information offices are currently operational at John Mackintosh Square, the Customs Building at the Frontier, Cruise Terminal and the Coast Terminal. The office at the Overpoint was closed in May 2015, and the office at Caithness was closed in October 2015, but was replaced by the office at John Mackintosh Square.
Speaker, with regards to the one at the Overpoint, this was in May 2015, what the government's position in relation to that office will it be reopening, or will it be going out to tender for retail or something like that?
Speaker, the office was closed because there was no demand for the purpose for which the office was set up, which is the information, and therefore there is no intention to reopen it at the moment. As regards what will happen with the unit itself,
and I had absolutely no idea of the stage. We now move to question 173. The question made the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise, as per the Chief Minister's New Year's message, how many letters have been sent to young people to start the process of purchasing new affordable homes?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, no, because we have not yet sent.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very pleased to the Honourable Minister for answer. I think she gave a helpful indication of when she might anticipate sending these letters out.
Mr. Speaker, I am waiting for another draft of the letter to the Senate Minister once a draft is provided to me, and we are happy with it, and then it will be done.
Mr. Speaker, from her answer, would I be correct in deducing that the question is fairly advanced, and that from her answer, letters are likely to go out within the month?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that could probably be likely, possibly before even. It's something that we've been working on for a while, so it's something that is reaching its conclusion.
And Mr. Speaker, in those letters, would the Minister be advised on purchasing the likely completion date? Speaker, a letter that is going to go out to people is not something that we're going to tell the Parliament about the content of it today. When the letter goes out, the letter will be public and the government will see it in the letter. It's quite unfair to ask us to give him the details of what's going to be on the letter to potential purchasers before anybody has got it. Speaker, I thought we were requesting Parliament to obtain the information from government that is necessarily public. Again, I ask, is there going to be any information in these letters that indicate the likely completion date? Bigger, we're not in Parliament to tell the Honourable Gentleman the content of correspondence that has not yet gone out. So the Honourable Gentleman can ask us to tell him what is going to be in the letter, and we can tell him that when the letter goes out, he will see what's in the letter. We're not telling him we're not going to tell him what's going to be in the letter, but the letter is in draft. It may change. There may be more put in it or less put in it, depending on what we think it is appropriate that we should put in it at the time that it goes out. And he will no doubt see many of the copies that will come in their direction once they're sent. You know, he can then ask us about the content of the letter, or once it has gone out. But it really better be that honourable members of it think that transparency and accountability is to come to the Parliament to ask the government to tell us what we're going to put in it, to tell them today what we're going to put in the letter that's going to go out next month. It's not anything that has ever been seen in a democracy, I think, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 174, the Honourable E.J. Hayward.
Can the Minister for Housing provide updated details of how many jobs in respect of repairs to rental homes are currently pending, that is, still not fully completed, indicating the date when these reports were first made by tenants and the nature of the work required?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, there are a total of 239 pending repairs. These are all of an internal nature and were reported to us as follows: 4 in June 2016, 1 in July 2016, 8 in August, 7 in September, 11 in October, 24 in November, 27 in December, 129 in January, and 30 in February 2017. given how huge the list of repairs outstanding used to be when we took over, honourable members, officers will no doubt want to congratulate us on the record low outstanding repairs now.
Question number 175, the Honourable E.J. Higgins.
Can the Minister for Housing provide an updated list showing the total number of homes which are currently empty, providing a detailed breakdown of possible of pre-war and post-war properties by indicating their room composition, location, such as the housing estate in which they are situated, and the date as to when these homes have been empty?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, there is nothing to update since question 75 of 2016.
Mr. Speaker, in regard to question 75, the Honourable Lady said there were 11 pre-war flats and 37 post-war flats, and then give me a breakdown between the 1 and the 6 RKB. In my question today, I'm trying to find out these 1 to 6 RKB, which are pre-war and which are post-war. And the other lady last time, when I had asked for location, the only information here we provided was north, south, east, and west location. And therefore, this time around, Mr. Speaker, I did put down location and again the sample of the housing estate because the Honourable Lady did not have information with her last time. In my supplementary did say really what I was looking for was to see whether they were in a room or state or rather better state or whatever. So that's why I repose the question in the hope that the clinical staff that actually the Minister of Information would by now have been able to locate the state people.
Mr. Speaker, there is no change in that there. There's been no movement in relation to the stock. Because you may recall that on the last occasion I did say that I wasn't willing to say that there was, say, for example, one in Laguna, two in Glasses, or whatever, so as not to encourage people to start a further house looking for the vacant flat or flats in the particular state. Because there was a representative provided in the last, in the answer to the last question, what we did kind of perhaps leave in the air was specifically what a state comprised the north area, the south area. So just to clarify, for the honourable gentleman opposite, the north area will include Glasses Estate and Laguna Estate and Catlin Bay, and the south will include Alameda Estate and St. Joseph's Estate and St. John's Court and Hitfield House. I think it's quite a decisive district, it's really easy to delineate. The upper town will of course be Castle Church and Lincoln Church and Castle Church, Tankerville and Bailey State, that's up there. And in relation to the west area, which is what you specifically asked for me after the end of last occasion, that would include Mid-Harbour Estate and Wellbeg and Chilton Court and Edinburgh Street. So I hope that clarifies the matter, but in terms of the stock, there has been no movement since the last question was answered. There's been a very quick period actually since I last raised the five-year question.
Yes, as I said to the original speaker, now, when the Honourable Minister last time gave me the details, he said the 58 flats, 11 were pre-war, 47 were post-war, but the breakdown of whom compositions all 58 are amalgamated into one. If we were to divide those now, which are the pre-war and which are the post-war? I don't know if I'm that, for example, there are 6, 1 RKB. Those 6 pertain, how many pertain to pre-war and how many pertain to post-war, and so on, up to 6 RKB.
No, Mr. Speaker, I don't have that detailed breakdown before me, but if the Honourable Gentleman wants to ask me next, then in fact, I would go further and ask the Honourable Gentleman, given that these are now empty, if he wants to ask me not next time, but the month after, it may be that they may no longer be empty by then, so that may clarify the issue even further.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that You see, that last month I was told together to that information, and the Honourable Lady didn't have it with us. So we ended up saying, well, if you want to ask next month, I can ask it. I have been clear in my wording here, providing a detailed breakdown of possible of pre-war and post-war property by indicating the room composition. So if the Honourable Lady wish to contact her department and perhaps later on the session, I think it's fair notice of this question of the speaker.
Mr. Speaker, the way that we've read this question is essentially because it's the same question as it was last month, as to provide the information by way of update. And there's been no update in relation to the stock because there's been no movement in the stock, i.e., last month we had X number of empty flats, and this number we have the same stock because for whatever reason there may not have been an allocation in the last 2.5 weeks since we answered the question. It's by way of it's because Mr. Speaker, we had the same conversation. Mr. Speaker, I can hear the Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition, muttering from the other side, insist of telling the Honourable Mr. Reyes to be firm. This isn't a going on, just explaining the way that we have interpreted the question that's been asked. We have been asked to provide an updated list. I am updating it from last month. Last month I had certain figures. There is no need to update it because there's been no movement.
It's in understanding that what has happened is the Honourable Lady is saying that there has been no change. But in the answer that you were given for question 75, not all the details that you have been requesting in your question have been dealt with. Is that the position? And therefore, when you, it is that you are actually asking about. So it is separate information which she didn't give you then, she's not giving you now because she is just saying that you didn't know things and that you require. Now, if she doesn't have that information here with her, I'm sure she will undertake to provide it for you. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Speaker, not 100% correct. I posed question number 75 last time. You know, we said, can the Minister of Housing provide a list showing a certain number of homes which are currently empty, providing a breakdown of pre-war and post-war property, indicating the room composition, location, and date? The explanation of the location, the Honourable Lady has explained to me this time round how she doesn't want to identify the particular space, but has been generous in saying, you know, in the north, by north, I mean Lasses, Laguna, and that kind of way. I can accept that, you know, that is just, if I were the Minister of Housing, I'd probably end up saying something similar. Now, my question this time, Mr. Speaker, I don't say anything further to or relating to the question, because when I tried that in the past, then I get the answer that there's been no change on the situation. What I have done is, I have worded it in such a manner to clarify better what I had tried to get last time, and therefore my new words are providing as detailed a breakdown as possible of pre-war and post-war properties by indicating the room composition. Therefore, I am asking as detailed a breakdown as possible of pre-war and post-war, which are pre-war, which are post-war, and what are breakdowns. The clerical staff that provides the information for the Honourable Lady could have also done a little homework and look at the handset and say, well, look, this is what he was saying last time, because if you have a similar question, let's clarify. As a gentleman, I expected my own answer last time. I don't have a breakdown, you know, of the one and two, how many or three, one poster. I repeat the question, and to be told again, I don't have the breakdown, Mr. Speaker. If it doesn't have it, I have to accept it. But certainly, perhaps your word, you know, advising the minister to get a clerical staff to get that up together and provide the information for an executive hand in an embarrassing situation, I would appreciate that as a business speaker.
I'm not aware that the speaker's authority extends beyond the boundaries of this building.
Mr. Speaker, I don't think this is an issue of staff doing their homework or not doing their homework. It's the staff interpretation of the question and the way that it's posed.
Let's bring the matter to a close. I think the Honourable Minister understands what the Honourable Member is after. She doesn't have the information, and I'm sure she will endeavour to provide it as soon as possible. So let's move on to the next question. Question number 176, the Honourable Indehaver.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Housing provide an up-to-date list in respect of the number of applicants on all government housing waiting lists, inclusive of the breakdown showing also the three list, social and medical list, indicating their rules, competition, entitlements, and dates when these applicants join to the respective list.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Quality.
Mr. Speaker, there are 217 people on the three list and 1,302 applicants on the waiting list, of which there are 137 on the medical list and 49 on the social list. Their applications are as follows. There are 1,179 for the 1 SOD, 83 for the 2 SOD, 167 for the 3 SOD, 77 for the 4 SOD, 9 for the 5 SOD, and 3 for the 6 SOD. Further to the dates provided last month, in question 73 of 2015, 15 applicants have since joined the team.
Question number 177, the Honourable Adrian Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing indicate by when it is expected that the statistical information in respect of housing matters shown in the government website will be updated as information currently provided is now 12 months out of date?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, discrepancies and inaccuracies in the presentation of the data were noticed. The complete system is currently under review in order that statistics going forward are presented as accurately as possible. I hope that the exercise is complete within 6 months.
Question number 178, the Honourable E.J. Hayley.
Mr. Speaker, further to question number 73 of 2017, can the Minister for Housing provide a more detailed breakdown in respect to the range of 1 RKB to 6 RKB pertaining to the house price requirements in respect of applicants who joined any category of housing list prior to April-December 2011 and who has since not been handed keys to a new home as of February 2017, inclusive of dates of applicants joining the said list?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, there are 245 applicants who have not previously received their keys. The house size requirements range from 1 to 5 applicants, and these applicants form the list as follows. Between 2000 and 2005, 19 for 1 RKB, 1 for 2 RKB, 1 for 3 RKB, 1 for 4 RKB. 2006 to the 8th of December 2011, 134, 1 RKB, 28, 2 RKB, 34, 3 RKB, 22, 4 RKB, and 5 RKB.
Question 179, the Honourable E.J. Hayley.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of how many tenants required urgent decanting from their homes since the answer to question number 77 of 2017, indicating the reason why, the date when said decanting became necessary, and the date when the tenants were able to return to their homes?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Housing and Equality.
None, Mr. Speaker.
Isn't that was also the answer of last month?
Mr. Speaker, sorry, I'm reading from the wrong page. Mr. Speaker, it's 460 times that have been voted for and answer in respect of one property.
The answer to 179, none?
That was also the answer of the last meeting.
Could I suggest to the Honourable Member that instead of asking the same question every month, because the counting doesn't seem to be a very frequent process, we might allow a slightly longer time lapse in between asking questions?
Yeah, but I think I can understand what you're asking. I'm very grateful for the Honourable Lady, because last month we clarified, I have been asking these in the past, last month we clarified the demand. And I've also asked a set of questions, you know, is there anyone still pending or waiting to return? And the answer was none. Therefore, my statistics seems that I think that was completely inferior. This time around, because the previous question that we referred was to, I go into the government website and look there, and because information is missing, I said, well, I know, given that it's winter time, you know, anybody gets to be moved, it happens to be workplace, it happens to come in winter because the flood is in the roof and so on. You know, I said, well, I told you now, I can understand what you as speaker are trying to say, so I'll make a note and I'll probably call you that
earlier. Because we're, precisely, because we are now in the winter, the Honourable Member was to ask the question from May, then he would get a picture of what would have happened if this question had come in 2 to 3 months. And there is no need to ask the questions on 2 or 3 occasions. And liberal, as the Honourable Member will agree, with all questions that he asked, which might be the same, but the answer is not the same. And because the answer is not the same from month to month, I am literally allowing him to ask the question. In this case, it's been no change for 2 months. And the author, well, you never know, there could be 20 people might be the candidate, God forbid, next month.
Question number 180, the Honourable E.J. Haley.
And the Minister for Housing is saying how much expenditure has been incurred in respect of legal costs relating to the listing of corporate and government rental homes since the answer to question number 79 of 2017, providing a breakdown showing the number of homes involved and to whom payments were made.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Quality.
Speaker, £150 have been paid to the CMCI in respect of one property.
Question number 181, the Honourable E.J. Haley.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of all expenditure incurred since the answer to question number 80 of 2017 in respect of contracts awarded for making empty homes suitable for relocation, stating to whom payments were made, how much has been paid, the number of rental homes pertaining to each payment, as well as indicating the types of nature repair work or human services undertaken.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, since question 80 of 2017, Ace Plumbing has paid $4,380 for one property, Elite Plumbing has paid $2,495 for one property, ASA Builder was paid $16,700 for one property. Liberty was paid $6,000 for one property. The work carried out by the two companies was general refurbishment work, including plastering walls and ceiling, painting, replacing floor tiles, doors, plumbing, electrical work.
Question number 182, the Honourable E.J. Haley.
Can the Minister for Housing provide updated details of outstanding arrears in respect to government rental homes?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, as at the 1st of February 2017, the level of outstanding arrears in respect of government rental homes stood at £5,225,585.42.
Question number 183, the Honourable.
I'm grateful to the Minister for her answer. I wonder, in terms of that amount, 5.3 million, how is the Minister accounting for arrears in respect of those properties to which the government is solely the tenant, and those for which you have to account for the rent?
Thank you.
If you've also had a graphic here, which one of the gentlemen may have involved with, so I'll deal with the question. Mr. Speaker, I'm quite happy to ask the financial secretary to give us an indication of how that aspect of the calculation is resulted and revert to the honourable gentleman. As you know, the whole capital assets is not a company for which we are answerable in the past, but I shared information with them. And then, what I thought was a very fruitful meeting with it on the member deputy for an hour and a half, and then an hour and a half with the honourable lady. Although they were very ungenerous with our newspaper when they left the meeting and went to the media about how things were going, but I'm quite happy to ask the financial secretary to provide the information. I think it's great to see from this day what we do for an interesting meeting. If you could just to clarify what just confirmed you will ask the financial secretary in terms of this 5.2 million for breakdown between those that are being charged to the government and those for which the government is acting as collection business. The figure is a figure about 5.2 million, it's a figure about the historic figure, and the only bit that will be relevant will be the amount going forward from the date so that these arrangements were entered into, not the 5.2 million. But I will ask him to provide an indication of how we deal with those, whether it's an exception assignment of rent to the capital assets, or where there is an area in respect of those rents.
Question 183, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government explain the recent change in leadership at Bruce's Farms Rehabilitation Centre? Farms.
Farms to the Honourable Minister for Housing and Affordability.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with Question 184.
Question 184, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state what qualifications the new leader of Bruce's Farm is in the West Coast?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Policy.
Mr. Speaker, there have been no changes in Bruce's Farm Rehabilitation Centre.
Question number 185, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government confirm that all those persons working at Bruce's Farm are qualified to be working with addicts?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Policy.
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Question number 186, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state when it intends to introduce a drug-free work policy for the public sector?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, this is an initiative of this administration, which we are very proud, and the Honourable Member's offices will no doubt want to congratulate that point. They will be pleased to note it is already in draft format and in the process of internal consultation.
I note from the Honourable Lady's answer to that question, and also the manifesto which in fact states the adoption of the drugs free workplace policy throughout the public sector. I also note that in answer to that question, she stated that it's going out for consultation. But the question that I put was one of the things to introduce the policy itself. Whether we have any other further information as to when the consultation process will complete and when it will become live.
It's an internal consultation process, so the answer to your question is pretty much be determined by the process of consultation, because it's a complicated policy, it's not a straightforward policy, particularly because it's a public sector-wide policy. So there will be different issues depending on which department of the public sector we're looking at. So it's quite complex in terms of the standards of the quality of the testing, ensuring that there's no contamination, ensuring that we have support, because the emphasis of the emphasis of the policy is really on ensuring that it's not a punitive policy. The aim of the policy isn't to punish in as much as it is to prevent and to support. So we have to ensure it's a human-related policy, essentially, so we have to ensure that everything is in order and there are obviously resource implications into the implementation of the policy. So it's something that we are looking at internally with all the relevant departments to ensure that we get everything right. I don't want to, for the sake of the students, comment a policy and then have a gap in supporting the people who we want to assist in by implementing the policy. So, particularly given the vulnerable group of people that we would be forward talking about when we look at the conversation.
Speaker, I would recommend that another policy, but one thing I'd like to ask is whether it's going to be rolled out in stages that make sense, certainly from this side of the house, that the type of safety levels to service healthcare professionals, fire services, police, first, and then roll it out in so far as the public services concerned. I'm looking to know whether that is being taken then to roll it out slowly in so far as the emergency services and thereafter the other public services.
Probably to the outcome of the consultation process, Mr. Speaker, because I wouldn't want to preempt what the advice from the other departments would be. The intention is that, it, that the introduction of such a policy would be safe.
Question number 187, the Honourable Ms. MD has been announced.
Is government satisfied that the list being placed on all government housing schemes and areas farm development, which was stored for over a year at last week, exposed to the elements of fit for purpose?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Question number 188, the Honourable Ms. MD Hassan Nouri.
Does the government feel satisfied with the health and safety arrangements and standards relating to the construction of the new car park adjacent to the St. Anne's School playground?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, yes. Mr. Speaker, cranes that are towering adjacent to the St. Anne's School, similar ones only last year, part of a crane collapse of Eastern Duke construction site. So my question is, how often do the safety officers visit the site to ensure that these cranes are operating safely? Mr. Speaker, there is, since the start of this project, there has been a professional team of inspectors meeting with the project team of designers and architects and engineers and their safety planning supervisor to establish the safety parameters. And the health and safety inspectorate is, of course, in direct consultation with the school representative authority. And furthermore, Mr. Speaker, inspectors visit that site very frequently and notify the project manager in case there are any findings. So, on the basis of answer to the supplementary question, on the basis of the involvement of the health and safety professionals, and upon their advice, and there is no advice that there is any health and safety risk in this project. Thank you for that. Does the school have emergency exit arrangements in place that do not include the school's playground in the event of an accident with one of those cranes? Mr. Speaker, from memory as to the layout of the school, then I think the answer is yes. And in any event, anything that is a requirement and with health and safety would have been brought to our attention is in the event that the answer will know when it will require and we need to make some kind of alternative arrangement for adjustment.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House is now adjourned to Wednesday at 10 a.m.